morning, everyone. I'm sorry we're just running about 5-7 minutes late on the meeting. We, with us this morning, we also have the Office of the Auditor General, which is brief us on the department's annual report, as it were, the findings thereof. We also want to welcome the Minister, Dr. Rob Davies, back in from so many of these important and critical trade trips and so on, and also the DG, Mr. Lionel October. And we really want to say, Minister, that we welcome the East now on growing the green economy, which we read reports about in the media and so on, and also the acknowledgement of the incentivization of companies, etc. And, you know, the awareness among South Africans that economists are now making in the public sector that only 3% of the South African economy is black-owned, and how do we deal with that kind of situation in a responsible way, because that's what we've got to do in the final analysis. But we do have some apologies here. I'm going to be making on the committee's behalf, as well as my own, another official inquiry on the Honourable Matasha's health, because I think I mentioned to you she had somewhat of a setback and so on, and we do need to just follow that up, Mr. Kalape, as to what her current health status is, and to give her some encouragement in that regard. I'm not aware of anyone else being away for medical reasons, but let us just see. We have the Honourable Williams away on party business. We have the Honourable Ian Hazen, who will be coming in, but he's currently attending another portfolio committee, etc. We have an apology from the Honourable McPherson, who says he's on his way. We don't have any apologies from the Honourable Nkongi, and I would ask someone to follow that particular one up. And we don't have an apology from the Honourable Albert. We need to follow that up as well, Mr. Willington, as well as the Honourable Chibambu, who indicated he may be here this morning and able to get away from party business as well. But on that note, we don't want to delay our engagement with the Auditor General, but just for the record, Honourable Hill Lewis, I'd like to congratulate you and your wife, Carla, on the birth of their very beautiful little girl, by all accounts. I've certainly seen a photograph of her, and I understand she'll be going by the name of Ava, a very beautiful name when one looks it up. Congratulations to you both. Thank you. All right. If everyone's in unison on that particular point, then we have somebody to propose adoption of the agenda. Thank you, Honourable Clarker, seconded by the Honourable Grenhoff. So right at 9:10, we welcome here to the committee. I know it's the Ms. Myberg, isn't it, who's heading the particular grouping from the Auditor General's Office, the delegation. Ms. Newland, the senior manager there. I'm not sure, is it Ms. Mpepe, the stakeholder liaison manager, if you're here with us as we speak? Or you shouldn't hide away from us in that manner, especially as you are the stakeholder liaison manager. All right, everyone will want to look at you. And we're immediately going to hand over to you, Ms. Myberg, from the Auditor General's Office, and we'd like you to focus on the highlights thereof and indicate, yes, it is a full document that we have, but try to bring us on board on the critical issues. Thank you very much. Over to yourself and your colleagues.
Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chair and members. So thank you for this opportunity. If we look at the trade and industry portfolio, I think in general we see that we want to improve that. If we, maybe I'm just going to put that slide up. Over the past 3 years, we've seen that in 2012, 13, 13, 14, there were only two departments or entities that were being, and those were FSD and FSS. For 2015, the department managed to move from unqualified with findings to unqualified with no findings, and it's basically as a result of the controls that were implemented to prevent and detect irregular expenditure. We tested that. After last year, there was an action plan that implemented that, and we were satisfied that the controls that was implemented will in future further reduce the irregular extensions that was identified in the past. The advocacy that also improved from unqualified with findings and no findings, the NCR. After that, the finding on material operations and financial statements, but also implement the action plan and were in position because with financial statements that were quality and didn't require material operations. So looking at that in general, there is an overall improvement in outcomes. There is one entity in LCA that was qualified. They were qualified since 2012-13 and then remained qualified in 2014-15. The main reason for this is the levies and the dependency on importers and exporters to register themselves to pay levies. When we audited in terms of the database that we found, that it was incomplete and as a result we had to find on revenue. So in terms of commitments made by the minister and the department, there is currently a task team to look at the funding model of the NRCA to see how this can be resolved. If I continue in terms of the highlights, and this is part of the presentation, so, but I think it's also giving the highlights. As the AG, we have this focus area that we focus on. Quality of financial statements, quality of performance information, compliance with regulations, financial health, human resources, and information technology. Looking at the trade industry portfolio, five of these areas showed improvement, and there was only one area, namely compliance with regulation, that remained stagnant. So once again, confirming that as a portfolio, there is movement in the right direction and that there is improvement. If we look at quality of financial statements, we note that 45% of the entities that audit submitted financial statements that required corrections. And those include the company's tribunal, family board, lotteries board, NRCS, and CLM. So that is really one area where a portfolio, there should still be a bit of focus to say, when we look at the processes to prepare financial statements, the review processes, starting work management, starting having the audit committee there, internal audit, these are all in-house review, or well, the audit committee is in-house, but it's part of the processes to make sure that when we submit financial statements for auditing, that it is of quality, and some attention should be paid there. Quality of performance information, I think overall the portfolio looked very well. There were three entities that submitted information that wasn't accurate and reliable. Even with the opportunity for them to improve the quality of information, they weren't in a position. So it means that there is more significant reasons why they didn't correct the information. Like, for instance, SIPSI. We have a challenge with the reports that is being provided to be able to re-perform and get to the same information that was reported. So, we couldn't re-perform, they couldn't re-perform, as a result, the information remained not reliable. Compliance with legislation, there we have 36% of the entities that have high interest on legislation are not compliant. It's not the same thing. I mean, it differs from entity to entity. Some only have one, and I mean, others have more. So it's not something that we can say, in general, this is a problem in the portfolio. I think when it comes to compliance, we also need to say what they should be monitoring, they should be reviewed. And if we continue doing the same thing, if we continue doing the same thing wrong, there should be some actions and consequent management to say, what, how do we predict this? And as a portfolio, maybe that's the area to look at. Financial health, actually doing very well. At 2%, there was no finding. Only in two entities, NCR and NRCS, being identified some concerns, but it was to that extent that it was included in the audit report. Human resources, also improvement, and there was no findings at the end in the report. SIPSI, NCR, NRCS, and Dan Board had some minor findings that was in the management report, but it wasn't so significant that it ended up in the audit report. And then information technology, I think that is a big area, 82% where we still raise areas of concern. Did it impact the audit report? It didn't impact the audit outcomes. But it's all around governance framework, implementation thereof, monitoring thereof, user access, security, making sure that the quality controls are working, that there's backups, continuity plans. So that area still needs some improvement, some focus. Quality of the financial statements. We spoke about this. As I said, there were five entities that submitted financial statements that had to be corrected. Four out of the five were in position to go back, correct the financial statements, and eventually be qualified. It was only NRCS as a result of the levies that couldn't correct. Christian to predict was Campanis Tavionoi, Dan Bold, Lotus Bold, and Shiva. Performance information, as I said, that area is doing very well. 73% of the reports were reliable and useful compared to 45% in the previous year. So there was quite a significant improvement overall in the portfolio. 100% of all entities in the department submitted the information on time and was ready for audit. In 2015, there were only 3 entities that had findings, SIPSI, NDC, and NCIS. What we do notice is, if you look at the donut on the left-hand side, there's one that is identified where we couldn't place usefulness or where there was a finding of usefulness, and that was worth in MRCS. That is really the basis, so they need to go back there to say, how do we rank our indicators and topics that is useful, specific, and measurable, so that it is useful to the reader. In terms of reliability, it's the 3 that we spoke about. Well, looking at performance information, I think I mentioned that. There were the entities that submitted initially where they had findings, and at the end, the same 3 where there were findings in all of the reports. Regarding legislation, this is a different area. Once again, we've identified 6 areas that we're reporting on. 5 of these areas noted improvement. It was only in terms of management of strategic planning and performance management where there was one, where there was a revision. Quality of financial statements, I'm not going to talk about that. Prevention of unauthorized regular and fruitless expenditure. We've seen that at 3 of the developers or of 3 of the entities, there were findings where we said that there was inadequate controls to identify and prevent regular expenditure. Those entities include NC, Gaming Board, and NRCS. Management of procurement and contracts. It was only NGB where we had findings on the procurement, management of procurement and contracts. But there was quite a number of findings that we identified there. Contracts amount more than 500,000 for the tender process that the contract wasn't followed. Amount less than 500,000 the quotations were supposed to be obtained, the quotations were made. Safety statistics that went in place. Declarations by bills to say I'm employed by government or I have family member that was employed by government that wasn't done. Extension of contracts that were extended beyond the acceptable percentage and the justice continued. So NGB had quite a number of findings in terms of contract management. Management of strategic planning and performance. There was only in our issue where was a finding and non-compliance finding in terms of the strategic planning. And as I said, 24% of the results were not useful, 35% of the information reported on were not reliable. Human resources and internal audit, there was nothing in any audit report. Information technology, and I've mentioned that, basically around the user access controls, the security management, and the governance framework. Then it goes to UIF, or as unauthorized, irregular, and fruitful and wasteful expenditure. Just so that we all have the same understanding, unauthorized expenditure is where the department spends more than the voters amount, or where funds are spent on things that were within the program, or that was in the group of intended purposes. There was no unauthorized expenditure identified for in the portfolio. Irregular expenditure is expenditure that is being incurred in contravention of legislation. We're not saying that we didn't receive the income money, we don't say that services weren't provided, we don't say that there was fraud. All that we're saying is there was a process and the process wasn't 100% in terms of what is legally required. Then fruitless and wasteful expenditure, that is where we say, you know, you procure services, audit food or something, at the end it was casual, and in terms of their definition, it was in vain and it could have been avoided. So this is really excluded. You didn't get that for what you ordered, what you paid for. Going to the detail, irregular expenditure for the portfolio, I think once again the positive sign is there is a significant reduction in irregular expenditure. In 2012-13 there was 104 million rand disclosed as irregular expenditure, of which 18 million was identified during the audit process, that is the brownish color. It indicates identified during the audit process, and the blue is that was identified through the audit teams, through their own internal control processes. So in 2014, it was 45 million, and in 2015, it was a total of 40 million that was reported as irregular expenditure within the entity. They were three entities that didn't process institutions through from the wash transactions, but there were three that showed more irregular expenditure than in the previous year. First one is the Lotteries Board, they disclosed 24.7 million rand of irregular expenditure, but in their case it is multi-year contracts that was entered into the previous year. So it's actually the non-compliance of the process actually happened in the previous year, and it just caused the payment was in the 2014-15 that it was disclosed in 2014-15. NCC also had more irregular expenditure than 7.3 million, and their manager in terms of in the supply chain unit, that position was vacant. And because of that lack of skills in the unit, there was more frustration of the legislation. This position has subsequently been filled. In RGF, they also disclosed 7.2 million rand of irregular expenditure. And what we found there is that they didn't have, or they don't have process of identifying contracts that is coming to an end. So I have the long-term contract, and I don't start my new process of inviting vendors so that I can have a new service provided by the time that the contract comes to an end. And as a result, I have the same contract, resulting in irregular expenditures. And then the last one before I hand to Melanie is Christmas and racial expenditure. Once again, we see a significant reduction in terms of Christmas and racial expenditure. When we started at 5 million in 2013, in 2012-13, the majority of the Christmas expenditure was also identified through the audit process. So we see controls are enhanced, and in 2014, it was the majority almost everything identified by the audit team. There was 2 million, and in 2015, it was 500,000, just over 500,000 that was reported as deficient waste in the expenditure. And almost everything, 96%, was identified through the entity's own control processes. The majority of this and where there was entities that regret and showed more previous expenditure, SIDA, rather than 1,000 out of the 500,000 was reported for SIDA. Then NRGS, 12,000 as a result of overpayment, and there was an amount of 37,000 at the department that was disclosed as the customer's expenditure. So if I can hand over to Melanie.
If you look at the assessment of assurance providers or portfolio, we see on senior management level there's two that's shown in green, and that's related to the CPI and the NCT because of the team audit things they obtain, and then nine down nine other entities except for the NCR and for the other FLES was unqualified, but this has other small findings that was reported. On the accounting officer and accounting authority was in 4.3, that those are for DCI, NCT, Companies Tribunal, and the National Lotteries Board, meaning that the accounting authority and the accounting officer, that's what was required of them in terms of their role as the deal for the entity. The executive authority, because of the increase in team audit things, we raised the executive authority in green as provide assurance. On internal audit, there's three entities that had findings on internal audit. Most of them, that will be Fipsi and the NGP, they didn't execute the audit plan as planned in the beginning. And that was due to the late appointment of the co-source partner to assist in the internal audit function. On the audit committee, it was only the NRCS that we rated as the that did not provide some evidence because of the special findings on revenue and it hadn't been resolved. On the portfolio committee, we also rated them as provider service due to the increase of a positive outcome on the audit outcome. If we look at the key drivers for the drivers of key controls for the portfolio, I'm just going to focus on the red block. On the 50, you'll see on the oversight responsibility, action plans on the next slide, proper record keeping and reporting. All of these red blocks relate to the performance reporting and the reliability of the reports that they get from the system to report and use for reporting on performance. So if they can improve on that and get their systems to provide reliable reports, that's also improved. If we look at the National Credit Regulator, on actually the red block there, that relates to the IT governance framework was involved. And it wasn't aligned to the BTSA requirements. But they, since the finalization of the audit, they have signed off on the IT governance framework, so that is now implemented. If we look at the National Gambling Board, under oversight responsibility, HR management, as well as reporting and compliance, there was a reglot. I will put it first on the oversight responsibility. The funding on the board did not exercise oversight of the trust. Then there wasn't a process of planning, budget, implementation, and reporting of performance. Or there was a process, but it wasn't properly implemented. Then there was findings on a lack of proper contact management, where there was contact that was that came to point and expired, and of course they didn't have processes in place to timely address that, that there was irregular extension. Lack of monitoring of controls to ensure compliance with supply chain, as indicated before, there was bias for the EUP on supply chain. Then HR management, there was poor performance contract management. They had a vacancy rate of 46%, as well as the recruitment process wasn't followed properly. If we go to reporting and compliance, on the reporting there was material misstatements that was correct in the financial statement, and also on compliance there was numerous findings on non-compliance with legislation, not only ACN but other non-compliance as well. Then, go then to the last one, CRCS. That's in the reporting. As for 1980, there was material misstatements corrected on the NRCS financial statement, and that's the reason for the red on it. Okay. If we move on to the next slide, the top three recourses and recommendations. We identified the top three recourses for the findings in terms of the audit report. Slow response by management was the first one, the second one was the vacancies and deposition, and the third one was lack of consequence for poor performance and transgression. In terms of the slow response by management, our recommendation is that there will be an action plan implemented, which must be monitored and by the audit committee. They must see how this action plan is executed. And then if it is necessary, then that should be amended. I think in terms of the internal audit function, they must also assess the effectiveness of the asset plan. And that should be happening on a quarterly basis. If we look at the vacancies and institutions, our recommendation is for the entities that fit with vacancies to fill those positions as soon as possible with people with necessary competencies to do it. Number three, on the lack of contract management, our recommendation is that the performance management system should be improved. There should be more frequent performance evaluation, and if there is any instances of transgression, those should be investigated, and the people responsible for those transgressions should be there should be consequence management for those. The status of the minister's commitment to address recorders. In the previous year, there were three commitments made by the minister. One was specific to the GTI, which was implemented, as you can see from the overall outcome of the GTI, the machine order opinion. The second one is the quarterly CECOVAL assessment, and also, that is also being implemented and has been monitored. The third one is the action plans for SHIPTRI, NLB, NGV, and the Company Tribunal to address the findings of predetermined objectives. That was also partially implemented. As you can see, there was no findings on NLB, NGV, and the Company Tribunal related to performance objectives. It's only SHIPTRI that still needs to work on to correct the predetermined objectives. The NRC is settled at the issue on the revenue, and that is also been shown as in progress. In the new commitments there was a commitment that the MRC issue will be attributed to address the revenue recognition problem. And then also the DTI and the NRC has established a team to work on the establishing a proper revenue model for the NRC. Then the NGP is also being assisted by the DTI to address the old funds. As you mentioned, there was a number of non-compliance funds, so for their work on that decision. Then if you look at the last one, it's a commitment to reinforce the practice of compiling quarterly financial statements to ensure that there's not so many repeat findings on adjustments of annual financial statements as the report is listable. I think that's all from our side. Any questions?
Yes, thank you very much. Then, and the last person to speak was Ms. McMullen, was it, the senior manager, and Ms. Nyberg. Thank you very much for that summarized overview. And then what seems to be coming through is that a DTI semi has been performed pretty well. But let us hear from the committee members to entertain some questions and comments. So, honourable members, let's look at yourself now. Please raise your hands, those who wish to comment, any questions and clarifications. Let's keep it about 3, not moving beyond 4 minutes. All right, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Quirnoff, is that a hand? Yeah, Honourable McPherson. In that order, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Is this strictly limited to the AG, or can we ask the department? Submissions based on the report.
We will be addressing the department shortly afterwards.
Okay.
But
right.
For ourselves, can we address the Auditor General's report per se? So that when we address the minister, we know that the facts or whatever we wish to ask have been confirmed by the Auditor General.
Yeah,
thank
that's
you.
Fine. Then I'm clear on the presentation. Thanks.
Honourable Cornwall.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just on the 2 slides where you deal with irregular expenditure and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, it appears that there is quite a dramatic improvement since 2012, 2013. Are you happy with that? And, you know, is it standing out if you compare it with other departments? And secondly, what is sort of, obviously, we would like to that column to be as small as possible, but is this sort of, on average, a very good performance?
Honourable Colonel, Honourable McPherson. All right, so you're quite clear about the issues that the Auditor General has given us. I just have one question for yourself, is it Ms. Myberg, sorry about that. The issue of the levies, which last year in the audit report we heard that really this was pretty clean and so on, but there's the anomaly about the levies, imports, exporters and the database. Can you give us, perhaps in your own opinion, going through this and auditing this, what do you think is the core reason in this regard? What is it related to, this issue around the database? Thank you. But yes, do address it. I think the Honourable Colonel also had a question for your comment.
Thank you,
Chairman.
If we look at the irregular in relation to furniture, yes, we're now happy with the improvement that is shown there. We've audited, as you also see there, that there was minimal that was identified throughout the audit process. And it is one of our key focus areas, so we do put a lot of emphasis and time on procurement management and procurement processes. But yes, we're happy with the work that we've done, that the controls that is there is working, that is implemented to prevent and detect, and we hope to see a further reduction going forward in next year. I think in general, I mean, if you look at the irregular
expenditure is 40 million. I mean, the department is quite sizable, there's quite a number of auditees, so I'm not sure what the total regular expenditure the government is this year. But, yeah, I don't think it's standing out excessive to be excessive in the bigger picture. In terms of the levy, it was identified last year. When we started the audit this year, we couldn't really see that there was a lot of work done in terms of updating the database. So for me, it was an element of slow response from the entity side, starting with the process. But as I've also explained, there is some dependency in terms of the importers exporters to come from and to also register themselves with. Through the efficiency, they're not identified. There's no other means at this moment to get them on the database. Within the SOS team, and that's what I understand, is there is ways, and maybe the department will talk to that going forward, but there was mention maybe about the SOS database and things like that, where they can get a more complete database. So I think it's two things. Maybe a bit slow action from the entity side, and there is dependency in getting the in and out state. How can we make sure that the database is complete?
Thank you, Ms. Meyer, Ms. Vermeulen. Do you wish to add to that?
Maybe just in in terms of the act, I understand that there is a requirement for people to submit their reports by the July and January, maybe to July up to the financial year end of NEC.
Yes, and I understand that that's actually in the act itself. The January and July issue, is it not? So, members, what we may have to do, that act was passed in 2008 here in Parliament. We may need to just pull it out, have a look at it, and see what it is that can be done to bring it into alignment with the, you know, the requirements for the PFMA. So that, in fact, we don't have an ongoing issue of the levies, which perhaps in some ways is beyond the control of the NRCHCC in that respect. So I'm sure when we come to the Minister and the DG, we will raise it there and see what can be done in that regard. But I must say, when I look at this overall, it does seem to be, you know, at least a positive approach to the requirements that you have, but it does seem to be in respect of the vacancies per se, what impact may it have had on any core issues in the DTI, and then in respect of the implementation, that if the action plans, are they solid, and the need to actually bring them into line with the deadline or the requirements specified there. But we would like to thank the Auditor General's office, which has a constitutional mandate to do the work it's doing and to enable us to do more effective and responsible oversight as such, and also the governance issues. So we appreciate you coming here this morning and earlier on briefing me on some of the challenges. Thank you very much, both of you. Thank you. Right now, members, we will move on fairly seamlessly to the Minister, as we see we've got here on the programme itself. We're looking at the Minister and the DG. And while I'm just waiting for that all to be set up, let us just go beyond the DG itself and thank the DG, I think Ms. Soan, Group Systems and Support Service Division, Mr. Khan, the Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Jodie Schultz, the Group Chief Operating Officer, thank you very much, and also Ms. Mabiti Thompson, DDD, Incentive Development and Administrative Division, I'm looking for you as we go through, right. And then Mr. Hursen, Acting Head Investment Protection. I see you're incredibly positive here, you know, looking at the media, etc., in the engineering news, as I mentioned earlier, on green industry. I must say, I was not aware that we're one of the top three investors in this area. So I learn something new every day. Mr. Zakorda, Acting Head Investment Promotion. Mr. M. Ibrahim, COS. Mr. Oh, yes, there we are. Mr. Madupe, the Head of Media. They're not here yet, probably running after media. Ms. Nchingili Dila, Head of Marketing. Ms. Poppy Quena, Agency Management. Ms. Reshne Pillay, Strategy. Mr. Stephen Harnival, yes, the economist, thank you so much for responding to my requests from time to time. Mr. Rion Maru, TISA, right. And Ms. Neo McCarthy, Internal Audit. Well, I was very happy at least to hear that the audit committees are up and running, Mr., and quite robustly, judging from what the Auditor General had to say in her report. Anyway, it's not over to yourself, because what we are dealing with, as you know, Minister, is your own department here. You see how it's listed. The briefing by the Minister and the DTI on its 2014-2015 annual report, as well as on its first quarter financial and non-financial performance. I would also like to thank our researcher, Ms. Akwanda Madalani. Are you over there? You know, for the excellent briefing notes and analysis you have done for the committee. I hope we all received that. Thank you. So it's immediately over to yourself, Minister, and the DG and staff. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning to honourable members. We also congratulate the honourable Hill Lewis on the addition to his family. This is the annual report and also the first quarter performance. The annual report is in this booklet. This book is not really so that you can all see me wearing a red overall with a hard hat. This is not a political statement. That was what we had to put on when we went to on the oil rig in Saldana. But that picks up the top, because you're worried about that. It's a red overall and a hard hat, which you put on.
Make some inquiries about that.
Make some inquiries about that. I wanted to say also, just before I do make a couple of remarks, that I would invite members to just look at the exhibit over there, just opposite to the entrance. These are a number of companies in the Cape Town area that have benefited from some of our programs. There's the Triggerfish Animation Studios. They were just launching, and you might have seen it on the TV, call for people to come and write stories, and it was supported by the DGI. They're two boat-building companies, and I think we just wanted to just say that this after operation for Fahisa has been gaining quite a lot of traction, that the 12 I centers have been dispersed to support a number of boat building projects, and you can see that so quite significant vessels, and then there's an aquaculture company as well. So I'd invite you to just have a look at that. I'm just going to make a couple of very brief remarks to start with. The main presentation will be by the DG. What I really want to do is to just try to say, how does the DTI's work fit in with the challenges that we're facing in the economy? And then I want to make a couple of remarks about the sort of approach we've had to management and improved performance of the department, which I think are evidence of the fact that we have this year secured an audit with no qualifications and no findings. It's known in the trade as clean audit. For the first time, the department and the performance of the entities as well, a little bit of new problems here and there, but also I think generally movement in the right direction as we heard just now from the Auditor General's office. So let me start with say that I think there's no point in hiding if anybody wants to, and certainly we don't want to, that this economy is heading in for turbulent times. This is evidence of the fact that the quarter that has just been published statistics for to show that we have contraction in that quarter. We can see also movements in currency markets and things like that as well on a daily basis. What I want to do is to say that I think that it's very, very important that we understand the factors underlying that, the major factors underlying that, and then look at our response in the light of those. And I would say that what we've got is we've got a series of aftershocks which are striking the world economy in different ways from the crashes which unfolded with the world economy in 2008. And I think I'd like to compare this to a series of earthquakes. But there was an earthquake epicenter started off in Wall Street in the United States. But the tectonic plates are linked, and so we've seen the epicenters shifting from one place to another. And right at this moment, we are facing a number of challenges arising in part of the restructuring of the Chinese economy. The Chinese economy has decided, and I think on the basis of solid evidence, that the economy was in danger of overheating and it continued to go on the kind of trajectory it was on before, that they needed to turn into their own domestic economy, raise living standards, move up the value chain, promote more of a service sector, things of that sort. We've seen that that has led to a reduction in growth rates. They call that the new normal. We've seen also two devaluations and then a response in stock markets a few weeks ago. Basically, more than anything, other belief that maybe there's more pain to come from China. But I think the most important thing for us is that what this has meant is it's meant the decisive end of the commodity super cycle. And all mining economies, including others on the African continent and now also oil producers, are facing the effects of this. Your place as an exporter of primary mineral commodities, you are facing a serious external shock. 40% of our platinum mines are no longer profitable, 31% of the gold mines, something like 50% of coal mines are either marginal or not profitable any longer. That's the stark and harsh reality that has struck us. And then on top of that, we faced the global glut of steel, which means there's excess capacity in steel manufacturing worldwide. And when there's excess capacity, then there's an objective need to reduce capacity. And that unleashes a fierce competition between steel manufacturers around the world to see who can foist off the consequences of that onto somewhere else. And that's an issue that we'd be about to grapple with in the steel industry, the steel tariff issue that we dealt with a little while ago, and which is still ongoing. So that's the background. Now, what does this mean in terms of how do we respond? Well, I would say that there's really obviously a need for us to act on an urgent basis to try to mitigate the consequences of all that. And I think we saw some of that in the work that has been done by the mineral resources minister at the Gramacordi in trying to seek that retrenchment slowed down, that the, some of the consequences of employment are minimized to the extent that we possibly can. Also, the work that we were doing on the steel industry, I think, is also in that category. But it also does mean, in my estimation at least, that the trajectory that we have announced, that we need to move up the value chain, that we need to add more value to our products, that we need to shift from this place in the global vision of labor where we're producers and exporters of primary products and importers of finished goods, that has to change and that course has to be followed through. Now, what it also means is it means that we're having to try to do that on an increasing scale because the challenges are more and more significant. And but also in the context of tighter budgets, so that means that we have to try to get more bang for our buck, and we have to be smarter, and we have to be more effective in what we're doing. And that, I think, comes into what the report, I think, will be showing us. It will be showing us a number of achievements that we've made, and I think these achievements are significant, but not of the scale that we need to fundamentally turn the economy around. They are achievements in terms of the performance of the manufacturing, in terms of the investments that we made in manufacturing, in terms of the continued progress that we make in a number of sectors. We haven't really, I think, come here and spoken about the need for us to move more expeditiously into some of the metals fabrication, capital goods, steel industries as a major focus, linked to the infrastructure program, which of course remains the fundamental counter-cyclical measure that we need to ensure continues to make progress. Also, we need to move into the area of metal minerals beneficiation. The operation Makisa, the mining ship that we hope will be able to unlock quite a bit of that. But the other thing that it means is it means that the department has just got to be moving progressively forward in terms of its ability to respond, in terms of its ability to provide the support mechanisms, in terms of its ability to handle all of the various trade challenges, promote investment, and basically to make sure that its administration is constantly improving. When I came into office, I decided right from the beginning that there was no magic bullet that I could bring in, or dare I say, Peter Bruce had his way, Norman Adami could bring in, that is ready to go to change around the face of the department, but rather that what we need to do is we need to work on continuous improvement, which is, of course, the phrase that comes out of the industrialization in Asia, where we make small and continuous improvements across the board, where the message that goes to all parts of the department, that is what we expect, and that we measure these and that we expect to see improvements on all of them, and that eventually what happens is you start looking back after a few years and you see actually there's quite a large shift in the right direction from where you are now to where you were sometime back. But I think that the department was a bad department at the time when I took over, and that it was at all, it was one of the better performing departments in government then. But it was a question of continuously building this, it's a question of paying attention to the indicators, it's a question of sitting down with the Auditor General and saying to the team, let's not debate what the Auditor General says, let's just combine with what the Auditor General says. I'll give you a couple of examples. At one time we had findings of performance. We had things like, we were writing down performance indicators like, we would work towards a conclusion of the Doha development round. Now, it's not remotely in our power to deliver that or not, but we wrote it down and they said, well, there's no conclusion of the Doha development round, therefore you missed your time. So we said, well, you know, let's not debate this with the Auditor General. Let's just not write that kind of performance down there, because it's rather say that we will participate in the WTO process with that mandate and write it down in that sort of way. The other thing was category of regular expenditure. We had people coming to us and say, well, you know, actually, this was because we did some advertisement on the radio, and there's not three quotes that we got, it's went to the SABC. So we just said, look, you know, forget those arguments, just comply and do it. So that's in fact what happened, and so we ended up with a high water mark, which now I'm saying to be the team we've actually got to maintain. Having said once, we can't afford to fall back. So that, I think, has been generally what we have tried to do. I'm also very well aware of the difference between the executive authority and accounting officer. The DG is accounting officer. The DG is responsible for the hands-on management. I don't try to be involved in that. So rather it's strategic leadership. And I think that it has been generally working and moving in the right kind of direction. So I think the report that the DG is going to give as the accounting officer, it is appropriate that he gives it. He's going to go into some details of that. And I just wanted to draw those to attention. And maybe just to repeat, as our colleague from the EFA just come in, look at the thing there that I said at the beginning, this is a picture of me in a red overall and a hard hat. I didn't join your party, I was on the oil rigs or not. This is on the annual report. But thank you very much, and may shout out to the DG.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Minister, Honourable Members. This report, as indicated, is for 2014, 2015, and it still includes the Department of Small Business Development. As you know, we were covered under the same vote, 36, and so many of the projects have been handed over subsequently to them, but under this year, well, we will still be reporting on that. As per our normal procedure, we will really try to cover some of the highlights, key achievements. We'll go through some of the key targets. We obviously won't be able to go through all of them, but they are covered in the full report. And then we will say something about the financial management and then some of our look at the audit result, and then we will then very briefly go to the first quarter performance. I think before getting into the detail of the report, I think it's really important to just maintain what the DTI is trying to achieve through its numerous activities. I think three broad goals. We're trying to restructure the economy so that we have a more diversified economy, and it's really about promoting industrialization, and that remains our most important and core objective. The third, the second one is really to integrate South Africa into global continental value chains. Thirdly, to broaden the base of our economy in terms of entrepreneurs, in terms of broader empowerment, and then most importantly, to create a proper regulatory and efficient regulatory environment by focusing on corporate and consumer rights. And then finally, we're saying to achieve all these objectives, we must build a world-class administration. Then I think the Minister touched on that, so I'm going to go very quickly through the global context and really just give the detail. But I think the Minister has made the point that the biggest headwind we're facing in our economy is the impact of the falling commodity prices on our mining industry, and that has spillover into the manufacturing industry because especially our steel industry is a big supplier into the mining industry. So a decline in mining has an impact on the manufacturing sector, and that's why we're saying the detail is there. I think it's very important to just emphasize what the Minister was saying, is that if we look at our four big exports in terms of iron ore, coal, gold, and platinum, and you will see then the extent of the fall in those key commodities, and that's why our mining industry is probably going through one of the toughest periods, is because the biggest impact has been on those core minerals like iron ore and platinum and coal as well. As also indicated, the structural change, both monetary tightening in the U.S. as well as the new normal in China, is the two leading economies or the biggest economies in the world, obviously impacting on all global growth, OECD growth, Chile, Canada, Australia. This is covered, and you can see. And the key point is that the best performing economies in these times are those economies which are diversified and are industrialized. And I think, therefore, the take-home must be that our strategic objective of industrializing and diversifying us to be retaining our goal. If you think of economies like Germany, the reason they are surviving is because of the high level of diverse industrialization. I think this also just gives you the extent and what Minister calls structural change. It's not cyclical, it's structural. You look at what has happened to the price of iron ore. It was $146 a ton in 2010. It is now at, what, $40 a ton. That is a dramatic fall in the prices, and that is what you also see reflecting in the rand, and you see it reflecting in the fall in the share prices of our mining companies. We quickly look at what happened in our own economy. In quarter two, we see a contraction on quarter-on-quarter basis, and then we see big contractions in mining, even in manufacturing, and then, as I said, the drought in agriculture. So those are both domestic and global factors driving that second quarter reduction. And so this just gives you a broad overview of the context of our growth, and there we see then the first quarter of decline, whilst we were picking up in late 2014, and in the beginning of this year, we had the first year's decline. Then, I think in a brief summary then before moving on, is that we must understand the causes why we could see weak growth. It's both global and domestic factors. The commodity prices we mentioned, and the electricity supply challenges, the global steel glut, and then extreme drought conditions in place in the northwest, and as I indicated, the spillover from mining to manufacturing is the cause of the current downturn we are facing. But then I think the one bright spot that we have whilst we are facing these headwinds is with regards to foreign direct investment, both domestic and foreign direct investment. The overall trend is clearly upwards in terms of investment. In the period 2013-2014, we attracted over 140 billion rands of investment. Whilst there was a slight decline in 2014, it was still very high compared to 5 years ago, and especially on the continent is still the leading investor. And that was confirmed in this morning's business day, which indicated that in terms of the UK, which houses companies like Unilever and others, South Africa is still the favorite place for investment on the continent. I think this just gives you the outline. As I indicated, there is a slight decline in 2014, but it is from historic highs in 2013. It is still higher than 2009, 2010, 2011, and so on. So as I said, the positive feature is that domestic investment and foreign investment is on the upswing. Similarly, with regards to exports, again, still 50% of our exports is raw materials, and therefore it is that decline that we experienced, but we did see that that our exports grew by 12% in the second quarter, and we also recorded a surplus for the first time since 2012. I think this also just gives the context to, as I said, there seems to be at least a green shoots emerging with regards to our export performance, and as we will come later, especially of our value-added exports in autos and other areas, there is positive performance. Then turning to the annual report, again, we will go into detail, but it will be divided into five areas of our work. It's industrial development, trade, broadening participation and transformation, regulation, and then the administration, and so on. Starting off then with our strategic goal number one, which is the heart of our business, which is about industrialization and investment. I think if we look at our programs, we'll see that where DDI has targeted incentives, like in clothing, autos, home, and business processing outsourcing, we are starting to see real turnarounds in those four industries or sectors. If you take the clothing, we've distributed 3.7 billion since the start of this program, and the bulk of that has been dispersed. We see then, in that, we see a turnaround in the building industry with job growth for the first time, maybe since in a number of decades, that we see jobs being created, 6,900 jobs being created. It looks small, but it must be seen in the context of an industry which was in serious decline 5 years ago. Also, we see really turnaround in the footwear industry. And again, that industry was on its knees. 16.2%, we've grown the market share from 19% to 24% in value terms, and the industry is growing rapidly. But also we see a turnaround in exports from our footwear industry by 8.3%, and that is a result of the incentive programs, tariffs we have, and the designation that we applied to these two sectors. I think it was important to note that in the clothing sector, we addressed the supply side, which is incentives, but we also addressed the demand side by increasing the tariff for clothing and textiles, but also providing 100% designation for all SOEs and government departments to buy from the clothing industry. So what we're seeing is a shift from imports of clothing, and all these companies can now produce. And also there's been a take-up from even our domestic mining industry, for example, is now buying all its workwear from South African sources. Then if we turn to the automotive industry, again, as I said, we've got a very specific incentive, and it was upscaled significantly about 5 years ago, and we are seeing the fruits of that as well. Vehicle and component exports increased this period by 8.2%. From 94 billion to 102 billion rand. So as I said, it's becoming a major export sector in our economy, and we've surpassed the 100 billion mark. Just to highlight a few of these investments, over 50 projects has been approved under the scheme, but the Mercedes-Benz is one of the biggest, $1.6 billion investment, and they've invested in the recapitalizing the new plant. What's important also, we've started attracting the big Chinese groups, both Beijing Automotive Works and First Automotive Works, and that in last year, we launched that plant, which is producing trucks at the moment, but they will be producing vehicles shortly. We've also seen the entry of Hyundai into the South African market, the 110-man facility. We've also seen Hino now producing trucks. We've seen Iveco getting into the auto industry. And then turning, as I said, to the demand side, we've designated 18 sectors already for products for local procurement. In this way, we are really trying to raise aggregate domestic demand for domestic manufacturers. If we then turn to some of the designations where we have done new ones on in the year under review, we've done transformers, power lines, steel conveyance pipes, mining and construction vehicles, building and construction. So here you can see what we're trying to do for the steel industry. Many of these are in infrastructure projects, and these products now have to be procured locally. So Eskom, Transnet, PASA and others have to buy these products locally. Then also we're talking about the PRASA, and these are the not the ones which are currently in the press, but it's the broader program of 3,600 coaches. We also introduced the designation, PRASA will be buying that locally, and that accounts, as I said, for the revival of our locomotive and rolling stock industry. Then I think Minister mentioned this, but we have now, in the year under review, we made a breakthrough in the oil and gas and Operation Pakisha sectors, and we've unlocked, firstly, the two companies outside here, Damien and Nautica, they are the beneficiaries of this designation, and 1.4 billion tenders already been issued to local companies, and those tugboats will be rolling off the production lines in November this year. So what we are seeing is the revival of our ship manufacturing sector, using on the back of not only the 12 Iron Center, but also the domestic procurement and the Operation Pakisha process. Similarly, we've seen significant work being placed with our local pharmaceutical industry, and for both the ARVs and other solid dosage tenders. Again, we still have the program called the National Industrial Participation Program, and they have been covering a range of sectors from automotive, communications and agro-processing. As I indicated, we've also launched the Gold Loan Scheme, which is really start adding value to our mineral, to our diamonds and to our gold and jewelry industry. We then just turn to some of our other incentive programs. As we reported to the committee, the Manufacturing Competitive Enhancement Program is becoming a victim of its own success. We are rolling out all our money, and we are distributing that, and we will be, let's say, completing our allocations well in advance. But in the year under review, incentives amounted to 1.2 billion rand. Astral Foods is just one of the examples that we use under the scheme, where DTI gave 28 million, but as you can see, the entire investment for the company was 200 million rand in the new chicken beef mill. We've also designated and allowed or pursued the geographical designation of rooibos, and this now opens us up this export market, both to Europe, especially in Alsace. Then, as I said, we've got we've done clothing and textiles, where we've got a dedicated incentive scheme. Autos, where we have that, we've covered designations and the demand side. And then on BPSs, again, there is, in the booklets, you will see this program is going very well. The minister launched CCI call center, which employs over 1,600 people employed in one call center. So this is also a good job creator, especially for young people, the figure lays out there. We also have attached to this program is what we call the non-ETLA program. This is where we place young people onto the program. They are placed in these call centers. They are given training, and then the majority of them are taken on permanently. So it's 3,000 unemployed youth that we cover under this non-ETLA program. Similarly, the fourth sector that I mentioned was film and television, and again there are 137 productions were supported to a value of 3.7 billion. Again, in the film industry, again, there is now a deluge of applications, and we are unable now to have sufficient funds for all the applications we have. Turning to plastics and chemicals, we just want to highlight this very strategic investment, polyethylene terephthalate plant by MPACT, which with support of IDC, 350 million state-of-the-art recycling plant. We have air products and air liquid separation facilities, which we highlight, African Oxygen and the others mentioned. Many of this comes from both from the 12i reaction centers. There's also under the scheme we've got the Sasol, especially downstream activities in paraffin, waxes, petroleum, liquid paraffin. Honorable Chair, you mentioned the issue of green industries, and as you know, we do have one of the largest renewable energy programs globally that has been identified by the World Bank. What we do there is firstly it's to attract investment into this industry, but also we specify levels of local content, which we will also put in to start raising the levels of localization within this program. It has attracted investment of over 120 billion rand thus far over the 3 years. As I indicated, we are trying to the strong local content requirements. It's currently 30%. And we are trying to pursue even higher levels. We've had significant investment in this industry. SMA Solar, the Chinese company Jinko Solar, which the minister also launched in the Western Cape. Photo about plate plants in Boekfontein near Kimberley. That plant has also been opened. So there is really a strong progress in this sector. And with the fifth window coming up, we see new opportunities in the green industry. Here we mentioned we have started wind farm. Then turning to what else we're doing under our incentive schemes, and especially the Special Economic Zone program. This is linked to our beneficiation strategy, but South Africa has 87% of the world's platinum reserves. The DTI launched at the Chamber of Mines this fuel cell demonstrator plant. This was really to show the mining industry, but also the whole economy, that using fuel cells to generate activity can be done. And as I said, after the minister launched this project, Implats then immediately offered that they would use this use fuel cells to power some of their platinum mines. And we are currently working with companies who will be building these fuel cell stacks in South Africa. So this is a very important part of our beneficiation drive. Also, there's progress in what used to be a dying sector, what we call the white goods sector, which is household machinery, the DeFi project, where we launched that side-by-side refrigerator facility in East London, 120 million. And then DeFi in KZN. Turning to electrochemical sector, I think also in 2014 we saw the world's largest electrical component manufacturer Samsung making the first direct investment on the African continent with a 2 billion production facility in Dubai Trade Port. I think some of the honorable members were at that launch, but that gives us launching back into this white goods industry, and we are working with Samsung to move from the televisions which they are currently assembling to other products as well. Then, as I indicated, the progress is starting to happen, and it started happening in 2014 and in the beginning of this year on the oil and gas services industry, and we have seen some investments mainly in South Ghana. Then just to give them the overview of the incentive schemes, this gives them the breakdown of each of the schemes. As you can see, the biggest program still our Manufacturing Competitive Enhancement Program, where we help 335 companies, and then we give a breakdown of the jobs that have been retained or new ones. And if you can see the labor-intensive nature of our business processing services, sector 7 companies, 6,000 jobs. Here, I'll just very quickly go through this, but the MSEP approvals, as you know, it is still concentrated in the three major industrial areas, Johannesburg, Gauteng, KZN, and Western Cape. But we can see that the approvals are starting to spread to the other provinces, like Limpopo, Northwest, and so on. This gives a provincial breakdown for the 12I tax incentive. As I said, it still reflects those trends, but it is starting to spread. This is the 12I tax allowance. As I said, this program is now also starting to pick up. At our last meeting on the 12I tax committee, we had 9 applications, and usually we deal with an average of 1 to 3 applications per month. So this program is also picking up and it's extending. Then, as I indicated, we are still covering some of the broadening participation incentives. A number of them have been handed over. We've handed over the cooperative incentive scheme to the Department of Small Business, the Black Business Supply Development Program, and part of the information support program has been handed over. But for the year under review, you can see the large number of companies supporting, especially under the Black Business Supply Development Program, 783 companies, black companies helped. Here is just the geographic indicators. As you see under these programs, the geographic spread is much better and quotable. This is the cooperative incentive scheme and its geographic spread. Then turning to strategic goal number 2, which is, as I indicated, is really about trade investment and especially exports. Most of the period, a large part of the minister and the ICA team has been on getting the tripartite trade area negotiations moving along, and that has moved to quite an advanced stage, and the formal launch has happened. The tariff negotiations have also commenced, and especially with the East Africa community. We've also, on the continent, we have also been working on what we call the North-South Corridor, which is the infrastructure rail and road network to connect those markets, which, as I said, some of the key problems is not only about tariffs, it's really about getting the infrastructure ready and getting our goods to market. And we've been working on that as well as on the industrialization agenda for the continent. Also work on SADC, a lot of work on non-tariff barriers, and also looking at specific sectors. There are also the negotiations that we launched on trading services, and Cabinet has approved that we make offers in the area of communication, finance, and transport. So that is now ongoing. We also are in the final stages of concluding the legal agreement on the EPA negotiations, but at least in the year under review, all the matters have been concluded. And then also in the year under review, extensive work, which you will see in the first quarter report, was achieved, but a lot of work was done on the AGOA and maintaining our participation in this important market. Turning to the investment pipeline, as I indicated earlier, $43 billion of investments was facilitated. As the minister indicates, all investments made in the country comes through the department because companies are asking for facilitation services, but also all of them apply for one or other of the DTI incentives that we have. And therefore, we have a good insight into the needs of investors and the pipeline of projects that we have going forward. We've also been increasingly recognized at Arbeids. We recognize as a global winner for attracting sustainable development. This is for big projects in Unilever, Nestlé, and others. The Donsa plant is one of the world's largest. We've been recognized for that. And also at the annual investors meeting in Dubai, we also were recognized for facilitating the best green investment project. Turning to strategic goal 3, which, as I said, is about inclusive growth and broadening participation. The most work was done around the Special Economic Zones Act, which we thank the committee for speedily getting that through the various processes. We have completed the pre-feasibility studies for 10 proposed special economic zones, and in the year under review, we launched the Dubai Trade Port, and that is the one where the Samsung plant is located. We've also completed the application and the program for Maluti Alpong in the Free State, and that will be launched formally soon by the President, but everything is going and the investments are already occurring in that special economic zone. On broadening participation, black economic empowerment, as you know, we did, completed the legislation. The new code was presented in October 2014, and we gave a further 6-month extension, and it came into effect on 1st of May this year, and we also presented the phase 2. And as you know, we have taken now black economic empowerment in a new direction with a strong focus on productive investments, supplier development, and skills development. And that is now in place. Also, we have the B Amendment Act, where we are going to be stronger in terms of enforcement, dealing with fronting and unintended consequences, and that was also promulgated in 2014. The first meeting of the new President's B Advisory Council has taken place. It happened in March and set the new program in place. And one of the key projects is the Black Industrialist Program. We've also completed and presented the business case for the BEE Commission. Work was done on that. Unfortunately, we didn't get a new additional budget for this commission. So it's not that we didn't submit the business case to Treasury. It is that we submitted the business case, but they said you can have your BEE Commission, but you have to find money somewhere else within your budget. But we have done that, and as you're well aware, we have now appointed the acting commissioner. Also, we are starting to work on the B equity equivalence, which is the option we give to foreign firms who are unable to do equity transactions. We give them an alternative to come up with different ways, supplier development, skills development, and so on. And we've launched a very interesting program with IEM, which our Minister of Science and Technology have launched with IEM. But we're using the IBM program now for some of the other multinationals. We just had one with Caterpillar and then other IT companies. We've looked at also rolling out under this program is to make it easier for BE companies to register and to get their BE certificate. We've got a partnership with CIPC where we use self-service terminals to immediately, as you register the company, you get your BE certificate immediately. Also, extensive work was done around the Black Industries program, and in August, again, many of our members were present. We hosted an Indaba, and in the beginning of this year, still in 2026 March, we held a summit on the Black Industrialist Program, and we are now busy tying up the policy framework, and that is currently will be before cabinet shortly. Then turning to the final one before getting to the administration is a regulation on Strategic Goal 4. We've done work, and you're familiar with this, Honourable Chair, work around the liquor handling policy that was prepared and submitted to Cabinet and is currently in the consultation stage. Also, we did work on Copyright Amendment Bill, Liquor Amendment Bill, Gambling Amendment Bill, and the Licensing of Businesses Bill. for tabling cabinet that was run through. The licensing of business bill has been transferred to the Department of Small Business Development. We are still continuing with the others. Then we've also done work in the area of intellectual property, the final draft has been analyzed on indigenous knowledge. We've done regional impact assessment for many of these policy areas, especially the IP and the gambling. We've also issued new norms and standards for liquor. Then turning to the final one, which is, as I said, is making progress towards creating a world-class administration. Our vacancy rate is 8.5, which is still below the 10%. On the question of women, we are stubbornly stuck at this level of, whilst it is high compared to other departments, we're at 47%, but we have set ourselves the goal of really, next year this time, we are determined to ensure that that will be over 50%. Disabilities again, we are doing quite well in regards to the 2.8% that we achieve. And then also,
what's the actual target for the public sector?
2%. Yeah, I mean, we're in sectors on the target. And then on the question of the city payment, as you know, DTI was a champion of this program. We still do most of our payments in 30 days, but also we are now, we've been asked by the presidency to conduct workshops, and our CFO and our GCCC unit are doing workshops for all other government departments on how they can create the systems to pay suppliers within 30 days, but we've achieved that again this year. Then turning to financial management, which you've said the agency report, so I won't spend much time, but just the context again, in terms of underspending, as I said, it used to be a concern about, as you can see, in 2010, 2011, we were at about 6%. This is what the minister talks about, constant improvements. We're below 2% in terms of our under expenditure. This is the budget, and I think it's important to note here that we've seen over the past 5 years almost a doubling of the DTI budget, especially because of the MSET program, the SEDET program, and our incentive program, expansion in our incentive schemes. But our budget was just under 10 billion, 9.9 billion. Actual expenditure 9.78 billion, which 98.7% has been spent. This is just a breakdown into the different economic classifications of employees. Again, as you said, the bulk of our budget is on what we call the public corporations and private enterprises. That's basically our incentive programs, because we give that to private enterprises. There are no public corporations we give to. And then it's transfer payments, and then the rest is goods and services. Then again, just very quickly, you just report, as I said, to repeat them from the accounting officer side. We were free from material misstatements. There was no findings on performance. There was no findings on non-compliance with the legislation. We achieved. I think, again, as the minister has given us the task of constantly trying to improve, I think this slide basically shows you in 2010, 2011, there were 6 findings. In 11, 12, it went down to 5 findings. 12, 13, we had 2 findings. 13, 14, 1 finding. And in this year, we had no finding. And I think that's sort of doing in practice of ministers indicated about slow but constant innovation and improvement in our funds. Then very briefly, Honorable Chair, I could turn to the key achievements for the first quarter's performance. Again, as per normal, we launched our IPAP in April this year. Our new iteration of IPAP was launched, and that's done. We've also issued revised instruction notes for our valves actuators. just to emphasize here on the back of the valve designation, we immediately saw the investment by the Danish company to invest in a plant to produce these valves. We have secured approval for these new category of products, the transformers and some of these infrastructure type products. Also the proposal for some solar photovoltaic system components has been approved, and that is why we see the back of investments in this industry and solar industry. ITAC, we've issued the instruction notes for a rebate provision for us for the electricity meters, again, so that we can manufacture this locally. We've also contributed to the SADC industrialization strategy, and that was approved at the extraordinary SADC summit in April this year. Also, as indicated in the McKinsey report, we have a comparative and competitive advantage in advanced manufacturing. And besides the shipbuilding, there's also work we're doing in the aerospace industry, where we do have potential for growing our exports. Also at the beginning, the minister launched this plant and the Toyota Quantum Sesfikile taxi project. And as I said, for the first time now, South Africa is not only using taxis, but producing them as well. And that plant was launched early in the year. As I said, we've already seen a lot of applications for film incentives, 18 film productions, and as I said, there's an increased use of this incentive scheme, and again, we will have to, I don't think we'll be able to meet the demand for the rest of the year under this program, so that's 18. Under MSIP, again, as I indicated, the program is becoming very, very popular, and we've approved 161 enterprises. Just to emphasize, after the presentation to the committee, we have caught up with the backlog, and there are now weekly, fortnightly meetings of this committee taking place to process these applications. Again, the other program where we help many enterprises is the EMEA, Export Market and Investment Assistance Program. 538 enterprises were approved under that program. This is a quick overview of all automotive, 13 projects, 12 Eye Action Center, Critical Infrastructure Program, and MSEP. There already we can see 180 odd companies supporters. The Enterprise Investment Program in EMEA, 558 companies assisted with that. If we turn to the strategic goal 2, as indicated, we've done some national pavilions and missions. We were awarded the best national pavilion at the Zimbabwe International Trade Fair. We started work on the Africa Export Council, and that has been continuing. The minister has reported on the APOA, but we have been granted the extension for a further 10 years to 2025, and we have to make that concession in terms of our ability to secure continued participation. And as I said, there's further progress on the tripartite free trade area, and I think we have reported on that in this committee. But we are basically concluding the text of these negotiations for the main agreement and many of the act. So this is really at the really legal scrubbing stage. We've also continued to sign our MOUs with our most important markets on the continent, Senegal, Zimbabwe, Mauritania, that work is continuing. We've completed MOUs with Swaziland, Egypt on the SWAN issues on the working in that area. And then also, the G will be pleased to note that the Cuba package is being implemented. As I said, the area designated, the investments are continuing in the special economic zones. There's really good progress, especially in Dube Trade Port. We've secured $28 million of investment. There's also good progress in South Ghana. After now, those investments was unlocked by Transnet and the private sector, and 26 companies have shown interest with a rand value of $2 billion for Southern Bay IBZ. And then we've also done a skills program because the pipeline is going very strong. We need to have the human resources there, and we've given 20 million rand from our ESG fund, Southern Bay IBZ, to start a skills program with one of the centers. We also continue to train people for our SEZ. 30 government officials were trained in China as part of a five-year agreement for training both provincial and national officials for this. As I said, we've indicated and launched the program of e-certification. E-code came into effect 1st of May, and we've also done a technical assistance guide for BEE. The Special Economic Zones Advisory Board has been constituted, and I'll get an inaugural meeting in June. The Itukise program is a program where we are trying to match graduates to employment, and we've already placed 1,400 graduates, exceeding our target. We've also, incubation, as we said, is one of our key programs. We've launched that handbook, and you saw Triggerfish Outside, which is really an incubator for the film industry or animation industry, and they are using some of those programs and methodologies. As I indicated, the work is ongoing on the weekend gambling policy that are for comment at the moment, and will be quite a vigorous debate around these two areas, the consultations are ongoing, and in the next month or two, the minister will be convening the Gambling Council and the Liquor Council to take forward these proposals after using secret sets of public comment, work around the National Credit Act, and as you know, the work and amendments around the Lotteries Act has also been done and concluded in that period. Just finally, I will share, if I look at just our expenditure to date for this quarter, it is we slightly 26% variance, which is a bit high, but as I said, it is also normal for this period. I think we were supposed to spend 2.18 million this period under review. We've spent so far 1.6 billion, so therefore the variance is 26.1%. But as I indicated, there is now lots of applications for many programs, so I'm sure we will be closing this gap as the year continues. This just gives a segmentation then of where the sort of under expenditure is, but we are monitoring it and looking at it. This gives the breakdown between the compensation of employees, transfer subsidies, and where the under expenditure happens. And I think it's slightly, our variance is a bit high, but as I said, we are working on it, and I'm confident we will be able to meet our targets. Thank you, Honorable Chair. That concludes the report.
Thank you very much. Minister, do you
want
to add anything, please?
No, not at this point.
Thank you very much. What we do want to do is not to break proceedings per se, in the middle, because there is just a tea break. Let me just point out two or three things. For those of you who weren't here right at the beginning, although we did get everyone's apology, we've asked the department to ensure that as often as possible they highlight some of the work and some of the productions, manufacturing, and people creating art. It's Triggerfish, which is, supports 100 of country's most talented artists, and you've referred to films already, and they are outside as well. It's an animation. And it's one of the world's leading independent animation studios. The other one is Nautic Africa, which is an able shipyard in Africa offering turnkey solutions. And there we're looking at 202 jobs per annum,
reaching 224 in year three. Jamin Shipyard, then you refer to the designations and so on, they operate more than 50 shipyards here and deliver up to 150 vessels a year, which I think is quite phenomenal. I don't have the number of jobs in terms of solo. It would appear as if a person concerned is ill and they haven't put on a stall. They're not here, but the Blue Cap Aquaculture right here, Cobb Farm, Paternoster, you're looking at 387 jobs per 1 million investment. And I mention this because they're all outside as we talk, and I really want to encourage our own members and anyone here in Parliament who may be listening to this recording to please take the opportunity and look around. You wonder what we're doing, and here in the Western Cape we're being made aware of these issues right here. I am going to stop the engagement with questions on while Mr. Whittington is handing out these investments, that's a minute, I just want to ask Mr. Whittington if he'd give this to the Honourable Jordan Hill for his little baby Ava, to him and his wife from the committee. And the card is here, which all the committee members signed. You may wish to look at it at your leisure. And I'm not sure how much sun the Western Cape is getting, but certainly summer is on its way, and you may wish to protect the little one's head during that fantastic process of summer. You know, when we get a glimpse of it, yeah. Now,
Chairperson, thank you very much. It's a very sweet gesture. I appreciate it.
And all committee members signed this because in the end, yes, we are all colleagues in terms of such good news. Another new member to South African population. Right. Looking at the minutes, we're looking at the 5th of August. And Minister, we just thought while everyone is here, it's time to get through these and then it's tea break. You're welcome to take your tea because after tea we are going to go straight into the engagement. 5th of August, you can see we had a few apologies, Fab, Matashe and Mkongi, so we won't participate in the passing. Page 2, what we were looking there is the Export Credit Insurance Corporation. Page 3, the briefing by the National Metrology Institute. Some of these you may have seen, but you will recall that they were incomplete, some of the minutes, and you'll see here 4.3. The committee requested that NAMESA submits a written response. We need to note these things, and we've now noted it as attached. You will get it right at the back. Right, on that particular note, please can we have someone propose the adoption. Thank you, Honourable MacPherson, seconded by the Honourable Albert, everyone there present, yeah. 7th of August, Friday, the briefing by the National Credit Regulator on the 2014-2015 fourth quarter financial and non-financial performance. Briefing by the National Gambling Board on its 2014-2015 fourth quarter. Apologies, the same people plus Honourable Colonel, page 2. In the Army, then we have the National Gambling Board going over to page 3. We don't see any points being made here, just an inquiry, an engagement. So it would mean to anyone following these that we never requested any further information. Is that correct? Right. Because I know we thank the Honourable Kalaka for presiding. We have someone to propose adoption. Honourable Kalaka, seconded by the Honourable Hill Lewis. Moving to the 14th of August, Friday, we now have the apologies from the Honourable Elvis, McPherson, Mantash and Williams. Page 1. Page 2. consideration of the letter from the Minister of Trade and Industry agreed to at some point. Honourable Kalagan, right. Presentation by the DCI. Now, after that presentation, some of the issues indicated an attachment. The committee deliberated and raised the following key issues. The role of credit agencies, etc. And that here is an attachment. It would appear from these minutes that the minutes that the committee had nothing to say for or against the credit rating industry. The need for a dedicated media campaign that speaks for itself. Is that correct? Then, I'm looking at who chairs. I chaired here. I do remember one thing happening, and that we did ask for some work with respect to credit agencies, but I don't see anything here. We also clarified the Kearney report with the Honourable Hill Lewis, you will recall, and you gave up the website, etc. Do you recall that? Yeah. Well, you know, we do need to get that, and can you please put that website in? It was a question. So, no, we're not asking these just yet. 18th of August, we have apologies, Honourable Deirdre Hazen, Mansach, page 2. This is a briefing by SAD, right? The committee requested that SAD submits. We didn't see what we asked for, and we've got it, we've got them all attached. Point 3, that must have been the National Lottery Commission. Right, the need to identify the area for the use of proactive funding. But we get nothing more than that, but we do have the presentation. Akisa from the DG here, together with Kapai, and they speak about it, the skills mismatch which could impede the implementation. Right. I don't recall asking for anything, but I'm just wondering. SAS? Oh yes, the SAS one. Okay, and that is the test. Can we have someone to adopt proposed adoption? Honourable, yes, just let me check there. Matiaki. Thank you so much, Honourable Matiaki. We appreciate you coming here to relieve your colleague, who, as you know, is in finance as we talk. Right, those are adopted. 26th of August. Apologies, Honourable Albert Hill Lewis and Tan Shibambu. Right. And there we go, page 2. Page 2, we have the adoption committee business. Informed the committee that she had consulted. Oh, that was that recording. It is there. The recording is attached, is it? The letter of the page. All right. You will recall that we did hand out the whole one page. Page 3. That, yes, 4.3. The chairperson informed the committee that Mr. Moiketsi, Macadamia, Nut Oil, Mr. A, etc., were on display. They had been assisted by the Design Institute to request for the members and staff to visit. Right, the meeting closed. Can we have someone propose adoption? Yes, Honourable McPherson, seconded by the Honourable Colonel. Right. Now, we've got one seat which we're not passing at this moment, and they are? Is that the 14th? The 14th. Just the attachment and the reference thereof, all right? Thank you very much. It's just before 11 o'clock. Perhaps you could be here at 10 past 11 or so. Thank you. Thank you. you know what we interview members to facilitate the closure of all the minutes, the one that we reserved our position on the 14th of August is on page 3. It did not have the you know, the website on it. So what we can do with that one is to pass it and that with the amendment that it includes the website. All right. So on that basis, we will get that website. I know we have it. It's a matter of putting it in and adopt it with the amendment. Can we have someone to propose adoption then with the amendment of the 14th of August? So, thanks, Honourable Bernal. Seconded by? We do need a second minute, Honourable Hill-Lewis. Right, with the amendment. Right, now that takes care of all the minutes in August and it will be September. I want to thank the Minister for enabling us to pass the minutes, you know, just the quorum, and to get straight in. For those who don't have all the annual reports, Mr. Woodington is busy preparing them. Thank you very much, Mr. October, DG, for that, the bulk of the presentation and the minister thereof. And, yeah, I know we're going to have a lot of engagement with you, but the reality is you have had a clean audit and you, that has to be commended. The progress that has been made in this department is very evident. Thank you very much. But on that note, let us allow members to engage robustly on the matter. And we are going to create some leeway, members, you know. We want you to have at least 2 rounds, but you can go up to 4 minutes. All right, so let's try that. Let's see by show of hands, Honourable Hill-Lewis, Honourable Elvis, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Cornwall, Honourable Matiasi. In that order, Honourable Hill-Lewis.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to all of the people who have presented. I'd like to make 2 comments. The first is around the practical matter of the way that the department has spent its money and the audit outcomes, and say, you know, comparatively, when one considers some of the other budgets, allocations in other departments across government, the detailed budget, albeit 10 billion, which sounds like an enormous sum of money, comparatively is actually one of the smaller departmental budgets. And in that sense, from a department perspective, the department must obviously be congratulated on obtaining a team audit for its budget expenditure. One of the trends that one has seen being a member of this committee for some years is that there is a marked difference between the department's financial management and the financial management in the entity that report to the department. And that difference, although marginally improved, continues in the report presented to us today. And one is concerned that there are some significant concerns about financial management at the entities. And this is something that you know, the group COO will know well. The committee has expressed this view in the past several times, that there's a need to exert stronger day-to-day management and oversight over the department's entities and really focus on building financial management capacity and overall management capacity at the entities over time. And that is still somewhat lacking. It's concerning that the NRCS is now in the red zone, as our committee calls it. In the past, the National Consumer Commission has been in the red zone, and it's pleasing to see that is now out of the red zone, but the NRCS performance is, of course, disappointing. Now, I'd like to ask practically what, I believe, if I remember the presentation correctly, this is now the second year in a row that it has received a qualified audit with findings. What are going to be the consequences of that? There has to be accountability in the public sector for not complying with the PFMA requirements. And I'd like to ask the DG and the group COO what are going to be the consequences of a second qualified audit in a row. on the outcome actually achieved, if, you know, the DD, both the DD and the minister have again made the argument that South Africa faces these extreme external headwinds, which is obviously true, but significantly downplay the binding constraints that we face here at home, some of which are kind of homemade, made in South Africa, fresh DGI last year, but not when it comes to binding constraints. And so the presentation by the DG again underplay those constraints. And the outcomes reported on, if one goes by those outcomes alone, look very, very positive. But when you consider the overall outcomes for the Department of Trade and Industry as one of the key players in the South African economy, it's clear that it's not going well at all. And it's always a source of frustration for me that departments, this is not just the DGI, but all departments are measured on the sometimes, you know, quite opaque and quite self-selected goals that aren't really that connected and related to the actual outcome we want to achieve in the economy. So, for example, this year, South Africa slid down the global rankings on ease of doing business, and I believe that's also for the second year running. But that's not an outcome for the department, even though that is something that falls under the, you know, by and large, mainly falls under the department's scope of responsibility. South Africa is becoming a less attractive destination for investment. That is confirmed, and it's something that we discussed in a meeting whose minutes we just passed. That is not an outcome that the department is measured against. And so I do sometimes feel that there is outcome displacement, and that the department selects the outcomes it wants to be measured against, and those outcomes are not necessarily related to the actual outcomes that the economy needs. And so I am concerned about that. I'll leave it at that for the first round. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable L. Lewis. Yes, let's move on, Honourable Elders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for a good presentation. This department is probably the busiest department in the country, but I also view it as the most important department because this is where jobs are created and the economy must be made to grow. Just two questions for this round. Against the background of the headwinds that we are facing from outside South Africa, has the department made plans or investigated ways to bolster economic growth and protect against global impacts in a more unorthodox way than we're looking at the way at the looking at the moment? We have got IPAC and various other plans that keeps us busy, and those, some of those interventions seem to be working, and some of them work quite well. But given the severity of the storms we might be facing in the future, and we don't know how deep that hole might be, some people predict that we face something deeper than 2008, but there's all uncertainties. How we can create protections for ourselves in that regard, especially by investing more in ourselves, for example. So a little bit more whether you have introspection in your side in terms of IPAC and your plans. Secondly, whether there's any studies on internal inhibitors that we have created ourselves, as the Honourable Jordan Lewis has referred to. For instance, yesterday there was a report, and I know it's in 34, strictly speaking, in your purview, but latest legislation inhibitors, for instance, it seems like the labour broker prohibitions that have been created have resulted in 50% job losses, only 8% permanent employment. And whether you are looking at those aspects as well and try to alleviate the problems that there's a balance between the free market and creating job security for people at the end of the day. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Albert. Honourable McPherson.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I just want to start off by making a few comments on the AG's report, because I think it really starts to unpack and paint a picture that is becoming more and more worrying about the entity within the DGI. I mean, if one looks at how entities are measured on internal audits and the audit emissions, it's measured as good at 82%.
But one juxtaposes that to the prevention of irregular expenditure or waste expenditure, cumulatively as concerning an intervention required is 82%. So there's clearly a mismatch between how internal audits and controls are established or functioning in entities and what those as levers of power in the entities are actually doing. And that clearly they are not communicating or listening to one another. And that's certainly a great concern for me. And I mean, the Honourable Phil Lewis has already mentioned the issue of the NLCS. And we know that one of the indicators from the AG has said one of their concerns is the lack of consequences for poor management and transgression. Well, that's gone from the previous financial year from 9% to 18%. We're kind of a situation where internal audits are being ignored, documents are not being submitted, business plans are not being stuck to, and there's just no consequences. And I think that we need to hear from the Minister what his game plan is to deal with that. The assessments of assurance providers for the portfolio, you know, when one looks at, you know, senior management, you know, 9 of the 11 is statements of limited process. I mean, there's no assurance, I think, certainly to myself as a committee member, and certainly not to the country as a whole, that senior management of entities are actually playing ball, both the DTI and its management. And I think that there needs to be a really big inward focus in what these entities are doing. I want to just also then move on to some of the statements by the Minister, because I think that we need to unpack that as well. You know, since I've been a member of this committee, every time the Minister comes here, there's a reason why we can't do well. There's a reason why we're not doing well. It's someone else's fault. It's another country's fault. It's an economic crisis's fault. Everyone else's fault but ours. Now, you know, for a long time, you know, the trade unions and, you know, certain political parties have advocated that we need weaker rand, because that's really going to drive up manufacturing and exports, and that's what we want. But exports are falling. So, you know, we ask for something, it gets given to us, you know, by and large from, you know, external factors, and then we can't take advantage of that. But we're not prepared to actually look at what are the reasons that we are not manufacturing, that we are not exporting. And all of those, as far as I can tell, are self-imposed. And I think that, you know, Minister, you know, with targets, you know, by the departments, and, you know, they're always crazy targets, you know, with adverts here and workshops there, that we measure ourselves, we give ourselves smiley faces and greens, and it looks very, very nice. You know, our targets should start, you know, reflecting, implementing the NDP to the T. You know, look at the contradictions between RCAP and the NDP, looking at contradictions between new growth costs and the NDP, looking at how do we measure ourselves against promoting investments and seeing investments falling? How do we look at measuring ourselves against job creation and seeing job creation falling? That's what we need to be measuring up to. Not so how many efforts we've made or how many workshops we've held. That's not going to grow the economy. But real and genuine targets that South Africans can actually see that this government is looking to deliver on, that's what's going to come. I'll leave it at there, and I've got some more specific things out of the annual report I'll get to in the second round. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Quirrell.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two questions. So firstly, I just want to add on what the Honourable Albert said, that this is it's a pretty busy department, make no mistake. And, you know, I want to congratulate the DG and the Minister, and I really think people do not realize how big this department is and how difficult it is sometimes to run it. And also that we're part of the global environment. And, you know, we cannot escape that. You know, South Africa was so fantastic, we would have been number one. But, you know, we are unfortunately part of the global environment. If Mr. McPherson can tell us how to escape that, you know, then obviously we will grow like like bananas in a good year. But okay, on the film production, you know, it's a good story. We're running out of money, but can you ask, tell me, how many jobs? You know, it's about 3.7 billion you are spending there, but how many jobs have you created in terms of, you know, do you have that calculation? If you don't have it, let's have that. And then it appears, you know, China is struggling, everybody is struggling, Japan is just lifting its nose, you know, they haven't grown for 20 years. Europe is not going to grow, but it appears that America might just be the engine to pull us out of this global crisis we are in. And I want to know, is our relationship, from a departmental point of view, is our relationship with the United States good enough that we will have maximum benefit if we have this?
Thank you very much, Honorable Bernal. Honorable Maniyasi, please.
Mr. Chair. We should be worried that our economy is not performing as we related to it would be assuring that we'll be able to create more jobs and sustain those jobs that are already available. A decline from the 3.3% experience over the last 15 years and what we have been, we are now experiencing, notwithstanding the global economy. Crisis is very worrisome. The DEI is a key driver of capital investment, and it is in a position to harvest whatever capital, wherever it's located, to enhance our economic development. But it's not to be doing that. It's because I would assume that it's not doing that because the assumption is that government should limit involvement or restrain itself in how it can enhance and boost economic growth, depending entirely on direct foreign investment, as it were. The economy, Madam Chair, is export-based. And this takes us to the next point of looking at the department health programs in various industries, particularly in two industries, automobile as well as textile. In automobile, we are told that the various incentive interventions have been considered and been implemented. But all what we don't know is what is the contribution of such interventions for and towards downstream beneficiation initiatives and what is the ratio or the equation between supply and demand. The country has been flooded by different cars. Of course, it's because the assumption is that South Africans must just consume whatever that has been imported, with no intention whatsoever to build our own values. We're only used to assemble, to provide infrastructure, to assemble values. And the government for the last 20 years seems to become successful with that, and there's no intention whatsoever. And if we are going to sustain that extent, chances of South Africa acting creatively and domestically in that direction is very bleak. The demand and supply isn't looking very good. We also want to understand what is, I know that the minister will have been raising this in the past, the role of catalytic converters as a downstream beneficiary output, in order to help create job opportunities, and not only to assemble whatever will come to our hands. What progress can be reported in that direction? The textile industry, We can only talk about footwear manufacturing, which has grown by about 16.2%. Our textile industry is in crisis. Factories that have been, were operating during apartheid in various country slums, in Ciskei, Tatuana, Wagwa, the Free State, Ngazakulu, and all over, have been shut down. And understand there is because we have had to stop the trade partners, trade relations with Taiwan in favor of being in China. But that has been at the disadvantage of South Africa's own textile industry. What measures are in place to address our situation? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Masayoshi. We've got Honorable Delanco.
Thank you, sir. Just one question. I see, of course, I must commend the department for being audited and very much better performance of many of its entities. And I can see there are also efforts to try to improve on the other three entities, which have been mentioned by the Auditor General's office. So if we can see that improvement, I think it's going to take us far. Just on the MSET program approval of performance, I can see there's an improvement in some of the provinces which were performing not satisfactory. But if you look into Eastern Cape, 2013-2014, that two approvals, but now so far they have about 23 approvals. Then also, I think if you look into that is Northern Cape and Northwest. So if you, do you have, because I think to me this talks also to the other part of the programs of TTI and government policy. Inclusive growth, and which goes with distribution. And we know these are poor provinces. Have you been able, I know in your other presentations, you did allude to what is making, why are they behind? Are there efforts maybe to try to improve and assist them? And then lastly, I think that, again, on the inclusive growth, I know we have these programs which, because TTI programs, most if you look at them, they talk to question of skills also, which is a high demand in our country, where the population of workforce, which is highly unskilled. And then we have these programs who are putting into place, and we have all these programs on beneficiation. But to me, the programs, our programs, those are the programs of our government. So that is why my colleagues, they will be so happy. And in fact, they must be, Honorable Montfessin, that part of this program goes to private sector. In fact, those that are beneficiaries more than any, and of course understand why. But I think that we should be beginning to really, if you look at the, what goes to co-ops, there's not that much going there. Maybe to balance, we'll have to look at that so that we begin to really move towards the inclusive approach, although we are beginning to go to the second. And I must also comment, because you can see TTI's contribution towards jobs, clear. And you can see the programs which are really geared and moving towards that direction. It's just that to me, we will have to make real emphasis on inclusive growth, so that our people begin to see, because the other thing which we should not be under any illusion, not all of the 50-something and plus million people will be business people. That's not how they are. In fact, we should be taking that out of the mind, that culture of our people, so that we are able, our society, to understand some of the programs we are implementing, why do we use, that approach. Otherwise, I hope the department will improve further from this position which they have. Otherwise, I commend for the department.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kulago. DG October and Mr. Davies, I think, while there's absolutely recognizable improvement and progress, you know, it goes without saying, it's there. But I think what we all do, one would like to see the department really addressing and just, you know, leaping beyond these hurdles. What the AD's office referred to as control and processes to address previously identified deficiencies. We have been told that the action plans are there. They are there. They have been developed. It's a matter of simply someone tracking the implementation. And the other area is, if it would be possible with respect to performance, when people do make a mistake, and it's quite clear that they should be doing this, and it's a mistake, it would appear if the supervisory element that recognizes, you've made a mistake here, now, we don't want to see that again, do X and Y and Z, that kind of broad tracking. The mistakes are recognized, but a little bit too late. If that could be addressed, when it comes to vacancies, etc., I mean, I can remember 9 years ago, I think it was, or 10, where, one jokingly referred to this in 2009 as the players department, and everyone seemed to be acting. Now it's just the reverse, so certainly that's to be commended. But we do want to address, in as short a time as possible, key vacancies that may lead to challenges. Because clearly the funding is there, it's not because of inadequate funding for a particular position. If that could be addressed, that would be very useful. And as I say, the timelines I've referred to earlier, it's related to the fact that your decision has been taken, the problem identified, somebody else must address the issue. Thank you very much. Over to yourself, Minister Davies and DG.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask the DG and maybe the Chief Operating Officer to talk about the entities a little bit. I will come back on that issue after them, and then I will go into the other broader strategic questions that were raised by board members. So maybe DG, you can start.
Just on the question of the entities, I think the point is taken that we still have lots of work. I think, as we know, within our CS, I think we still have a qualified audit there, and as I said, lots of that is only constrained, but it's really linked to their revenue model, is in terms of the way they collect license fees. But I think we've interacted with the AG, with the minister, with the CEO of the entity, and we are hoping that matter will be decisively addressed. In terms of how we collect the fees and how that can be done, which makes it then sort of sustainable. You must remember that this agency was in major crisis a few years back, where basically there was massive fraud, irregular expenditure, and so on. And as you know, the minister took decisive actions. We dissolved the board. We also fired the CEO, previous CEO. There's a complete new management in place in the RCS. And you can see then, whilst it's still there's one issue outstanding, most of the other problems have been addressed in the RCS. So I think, as I said, while there's still work to do, there's definitely a progress on that. As you know, some of the problem was in NCC. Again, we had qualified audit, we had problems, but we've appointed a new commissioner and a new deputy commissioner in NCC, and a lot of these problems of financial management is actually a reflection of the responsibilities of the commissioner, the CEO, the leadership, and their guidance they provide. So I think the first to really ensure that you have proper financial management is to ensure that you have proper staff in place. So I think in both the NCC we can see the improvements that have been made under the new leadership. As you go to address this problem of the agency, we found that the boards were not actually performing their function of ensuring good governance. Many of the times, many of the fraud was linked actually to board members. And I think that's why we made a decision about 3 years ago that we are no longer going to rely on the boards. We have, like in the DBI, an accounting officer who is responsible for management, and then you have an audit committee and the executive authority overseeing the accounting officer. And I think that's why we can see now the improvements in there. But that is the thing. But I think we can show the committee that we also establish a structure of the entities where, with our audit committee chairing it, we now meet twice a year with all the audit committees of agencies and the audit chairs. They are meeting regularly so that we can have a standard best practice across the DTI agency, and the matter of the discrepancies between the agencies and the DTI will be dealt with, I think. So we create a permanent structure so that we ensure that we do that. We've also created a similar structure around broader labor relations matter, because we find that these entities, there's always labor relations disputes and so on. We've created a joint, on the instruction of the minister, we've created a one collective bargaining arrangement for all the agencies where we share ideas on best practice on how to manage these matters and so on. So, as I said, we are active in this area of trying to get our agencies and DDI at a higher level of governance than the majority wants to do.
Thank you, Chair Minister Deji. I think just to add on to what Deji indicated, I think the qualification at the NRCS is a technical qualification, and it's around the levies. There are two issues. It's around the period in which levies are elected, and then the other is the totality of the of all the companies who need to pay those levies. So I think the interaction between the AG and the management is that this problem cannot be fixed in one financial year. It is going to take about 2 to 3 years for the problem to be fixed. The NRCS in this financial year is committed to implementing an automated system to look at how levies are, so you can apply online for that. And I think there are plans in place to look at that. And I think just as the DG has also indicated, the role of the audit commitment, strengthening the audit committees at the agency is also a key focus. And so we have our internal audit unit playing a key role in terms of assisting to appoint strong audit committee members, and then our audit committee chairperson and audit committee also wants to meet with the chairs of the entities, I think, biannually, and that means then that we also get a report sent through the minister of each quarterly audit committee so that he's also kept abreast of those issues. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. I just wanted to say that from my side on this issue, that first of all, the picture is not one that all the entities are performing badly. Actually, some of the entities and the audit outcomes have performed, have had been audits for longer than this line, something like the National Consumer Tribunal, Euro Standard, those entities have had clean audits for quite a number of years now. What I do want to say is I think that the team has handled the NRCS issue. The NRCS is in a much better place than it was a few years ago on financial performance. I think the issues are largely matters of a technical, but I think that my issues will be that they must actually address the matter and they must improve. That's what it is about. Let me just say that the entities where we have had, where we've got a few of those problems with the National Gambling Board, I'm glad to hear that the committee as a whole, all members across it, are saying that the minister must take an active role in overseeing and monitoring that these entities actually perform.
And I say that because we had pushback in a number of us, including the NRC as a past, when it had a board, including the gambling board, including one or two of the other entities, where we've been told we're independent, but out. It's none of your business. That's what I've been told. That's what the Consumer Commission one stage was exactly the same. And what I've learned is whenever somebody's telling me that, be deeply suspicious. Because the chances that they want to be super independent so they can do their job better are actually probably less than the chances that they are wanting to need to buy out because they can hide something which is nefarious. So I think that I'm glad to see that everyone is saying that, and that is the message that we will take up. We will expect all the entities to respond. I always write them a letter when we get the audit outcomes. We will expect them to actually implement what has been advised from the Auditor General. I said this already in the department. We don't want to sit up there and for them to tell us why technically they can't improve their revenue model and perform and get out of being a qualified audit. We want them to take steps so that they can do that. Let me move on to the other questions. Now, I think now we're getting into are the fundamental problems our own creation? Well, you know, I think a little bit of context is there as relevant. I don't know whether people know, but in the quarter ending June, Australia's GDP growth is 0.2%. Canada and Brazil were in recession. Australia had a 3% drop in its export earnings. And I saw a quote from a report saying that this is the weakest growth in nominal GDP since 1961-62 in Australia. As I said, Canada and Brazil are in recession. Mining economies around the world, many other countries in Africa, are suffering from this phenomenon called the end of the commodity super cycle. And someone wants to say that this is not the fundamental challenge that's facing us right now. All I can say is I don't know what planet you're living on. That does not mean that everything is perfect in the internal operation of the economy. The 9-point plan that the President announced is exactly intended to address a number of weaknesses in terms of our own management, and they go over things like the energy issue, where I think that you can see there's a very substantial stabilization of the energy situation compared to what it was at the beginning of the year or the end of last year. I think you can see that there are things like on the labor relations front, where fundamental challenge that was identified, and I would like to argue is still the fundamental challenge, is to avoid acrimonious and damaging labor conflicts, not to poke here and there in terms of things that may be of short-term benefit, but which could provoke a reaction and industrial action. That is something which has been done by the Deputy President. And then there are all kinds of other parts of it, including improving the investment environment by constructing the new investment agency, obviously the DTI is a key player, but which will be housed at the Presidency, but which will have communication with relevant government departments so that it can ease the entry of investors into the economy. Those are the things that we've been trying to do, and I think that the 9-point plan is telling us that these are things that have to be done. And these are things to address the challenges that we face. But now, you know, the Honourable Little Lewis, he makes a point and then he goes, so I have to respond in the vacuum to him. I can't debate with him. But he wants to say that we have been falling down on indicators of ease of doing business. We'll just go look at business status today. We see that the United Kingdom says that we are the best investment destination in Africa. And that's what they say. There's a whole lot of things about the ease of doing business. We're taking steps to ensure that it's much less costly, much less hassle to register a company, for example, to do this online. And I gave some figures once of our products in that regard. Are we a less attractive destination for foreign investment? Like a war came like that. I got it. What has happened is that we've got, obviously, foreign investors are not pouring money into mining industries, either in South Africa or in Canada or in Brazil or Australia. They're not. And I'm sure that we're affected by that, but does that mean there's a general withdrawal of foreign investors from other sectors, and particularly manufacturing in South Africa? I think not. I think the figures are showing us absolutely not. Let me give you a concrete example. I will be going in a little while to open the hall of four
plants that have been opened by Unilever in South Africa. The global CEO of Unilever is a gentleman called Mr. Paul Polman. Mr. Polman has come here to South Africa. He believes that South Africa is a key player in African industrialization, and he believes in the African industrialization story. Mr. Polman is a citizen of the Netherlands, working from a company which is actually based in the UK. He says he doesn't see any prospects of any significance from growing businesses in the European Union. He's looking to emerging markets. He told me that they are very invested in 33 factories around the world, mostly in emerging markets. Four of those in South Africa. That's more than proportional to the total. So I think this happening all over the place. And by the way, we are very capable of performing in manufacturing. I don't know if you've seen this billboard up and down from the airport towards Tshwane, and it's from BMW. BMW's won the Platinum Award for the J.D. Power World Award for the best plant in manufacturing plant. This is the Rosenthal plant. It's actually up for the plant in Germany. I met the CEO yesterday. It's really helping. I went to the Chinese investor that's invested in ISIS. I went to something in Mehran the other day. And they told me that South Africa was the second most affected plant in their stable outside of China. So I said, well, who's number one? They said, the United States. I said, who's number three? Australia. Who follows them? Several countries in Europe. We are actually capable of being a manufacturing country. Now, I said earlier on that we've got to continue to make the structural changes that we need to make. We do not have a future as a country or as a continent if we are going to be content to be producers and exporters of primary mineral commodities. If we once hope that the mineral price will bounce back one day, well, it might, but it's not going to go to the levels it was when the commodity cycle was ready, because there's a structural factor that is explained in this. That is the change in the Chinese profile. That's the factor. So what are we going to have to do? We have to look very carefully at what it is, and the Honourable Kalafi is quite right, it's about inclusive growth. It's not just growth, it's inclusive growth. What is it that's going to drive 5% inclusive growth, which is the sort of target that we set ourselves? Well, we look back 84 quarters from the end of last year. We said, when did we have 5% growth? In 17 of them. 17 of the 84. What drove it then? A consumption-led boom with high levels of imports, and secondly, the commodities in the cycle. Neither of these is available to drive growth of 5%. It's alone being inclusive as we move forward. So what's going to drive it? We've got to move up the value chain. That's sort of work which we're doing. Now, I think one of the other points that I made was when I came here to the committee is that we see the programs of the GTI, particularly the industrial programs, they don't have a result tomorrow. You introduce a new program and the following Thursday, everything's fine and dandy. It doesn't work like that. These things are policy platforms that have their impact a few years later on. That's the story with the clothing and textiles. Now, the Honourable Mataisa asked us about that. That industry was bleeding to death. It was bleeding to death. Textiles were clothing, but clothing as well. We were being swamped with imports. People were sitting around and telling us that this was an industry that was doomed. There's no point in trying to work to save clothing production in South Africa because we can't do it. That's the problem. In fact, let me just say that this province and the party that is represented by the Honourable MacPherson, in his provincial development plan called this a sunset industry. It was going down, we had to accept that. We didn't adopt that view. We actually said, what is it that is wrong with the clothing industry and what can we do to make it right? And what we said was we said that the clothing industry, the problem was you sent a scheme that was there before, was just getting money to the bottom line. It was based on export performance. People were earning duty credit certificates. We were not defending our borders. We were not actually trying to deal with illegal imports. We were not doing anything like trying to get local production based on localization. And if we put some of this in place, we could turn this industry around. I think that what the figures have shown us is just a little snapshot of that. I am going to go next week, I think it is. I'm going to go and have a meeting with somebody I met in Fujini. Man who is the buyer for Fujini. He is perfectly willing to buy imports across the world. When I met him, he just come back from Madagascar. He was perfectly happy to buy imports around the world. But he's telling me that now South African clothing manufacturers are able to respond to the fast fashion on a scale and with a quality and with a price that makes economic sense to a company like Ushiri. I showed the picture before we were here, the picture of the tents. About 3 years ago, that company was making little tents, two tents next to each other with a little thing in the middle for families to go camping. Now it's run this huge tent in Dubai. Those are the things that have been happening in this economy. And what I want to say is that no, we have not achieved what we need to achieve. That the manufacturing sector is driving a new growth path. This is reflected in the macro figures. We are still too tied in our manufacturing to the fortunes of the mining industry. Our parts of our sector are very vulnerable to things like the energy situation. But I think that we have shown that when we've been purposeful, we can act. Now, this is our challenge. Now, the Honourable McPherson says, we must go back and we must say, what parts are we going to do the NDP? And we must resolve the contradictions between ITAP and the NGP and the NDP. I want to say that at the start of ITAP, we actually said that ITAP was moving in the same strategic direction as the NDP. That was the start, those were the first introductory chapters of ITAP. I want to ask the Honourable McPherson, the Honourable Hill Lewis, and their party, if they want to say that there are contradictions between ITAP and the NDP, what parts of ITAP do you suggest that we pull? What programs do you suggest that we don't operate in the way that we are doing? And please go out and start to go and tell those people outside it, which parts of the program you have to pull, and what is it going to mean to industries and manufacturing sectors that are actually involved in the Western country. Please do not, if you do not believe in ITAP, do not go out and try to claim the credit for investments in manufacturing that happened in this province, and happened very largely because of the impact of our incentives, and claim the credit for that, and then just own the program. That is called hypocrisy. If you want to be honest, then you must say, we don't believe in ITAP, we don't believe in it, it's not our program, the benefits of it that are manifested in a number of investments are not yours either. I think that's what we need is an honesty in the conversation. Let me talk about the film industry, Ms. Rose. I don't know if I have the figures for the film industry, but we've more or less quadrupled the number of films that are produced. Let me say that the films do not come to South Africa and the Western Cape because of the beauty of Table Mountain and the facilities that are there at the film studio. They do not. Because a few years ago, Australia, which has got wonderful studios and wonderful scenery, also put the incentive. They do not go there. California also has a much less attractive incentive, which is why you see so many films that are filmed in Louisiana and in the state of New York, because they have a better incentive. They come here because of the film rebate scheme. That's why they come here. And by the way, if you don't like the arms deal, then please don't claim the Cape Town Film Studio, because it was part of finance by one of the offsets from the arms deal. That, I think, is the kind of honest conversation that we need to have. What is it in our program in detail that you think is wrong, and what should we be putting in our program? That's what I think I want to say, that I believe that our program has actually shown us that we are making progress, but not on scale. We need to increase the scale of our program under very difficult and very tight circumstances as we try to deal with and mitigate some of the very, very serious effects that might be staring us in the face as a result of the latest whammy to hit us. Now, what about the weaker rand? The weaker rand, that's supposed to be, we call for a weaker rand. Well, some of us actually, we said that the rand a few years ago was overvalued. It wasn't just me that said it, it was the IMF that said it. When the rand was sitting around 6 or 7 to the US dollar, the IMF said it was 10 to 15% overvalued. What does that do? That means that exports are disadvantaged. Exports were not able to access markets that were in any case depressed because of the crisis. And at the same time, we see the imports coming in. Now we've got a different situation. We've got a rand which is probably undervalued, not overvalued. But fortunately, we also have an oil price drop, which has meant that we're not having the major inflationary effects that we would have otherwise. But actually, the DG's figures showed us that there was an improvement in export performance. Why do we see export earnings falling in some cases? It's because our export basket continues to be dominated by primary products, mineral products. We're talking about autos and things like that, which are actually performing relatively well in terms of exports. Our exports to the African continent are performing relatively well, value-added products. So I think that it's not the case that that we ever, no certain of me, ever saw this as a magic bullet that would solve everything, and that the RAND as weak as it could be is the ideal, because markets over and undershoot. They overshot before, now they're undershooting, for sure. I think that's where we find ourselves. Let me just say that I think probably the last question I want you to answer is the one from the Honourable Colonel, the United States. Well, you know, I don't think that any part of the world or our relationship with any part of the world is really going to get us out of where we are. What is actually leading the United States to be one of the best of community colleges? One of the things that's very, very important is they have decided to focus on reindustrializing their country. A few years ago, people that were of the neoliberal frame of mind were arguing that we do not need manufacturing any longer. We can become, or at least the developed world, can become post-industrial economies. Focus on service sectors. By services, they generally mean speculative financial services. That's generally what they mean. That was a mantra around. And I think that countries have followed that and ruined the day. But they have, Germany did not manifest it. It did much better than other countries. And I think every single industrialized country that followed that, that had that mantra before, it's reversed. They've gone back into industrialization, industrial development. That's what the US has done. They don't have cheap energy, by the way, based on shale gas. That's what it had. That was the formula for the better performance of the US. Is our relationship with the US as good as it could be? Well, we've just gone through this review under the Obama. We still have to resolve a few of the issues about SPS, particularly with chips. I think that is the only issue which is outstanding. The pork one and the beef one, I think, are much more resolved. But I'm basing this on conversations I had with the U.S. Trade Representative in Gabon, where we had the Agoa Forum a week or two ago. We are having a further engagement with our bench, but we hope that we can still solve those matters, because I think the Agoa relationship is the basis of our relationship with the U.S. It has led to a growing trade relationship, it's led to an investment relationship, and it has also meant that our export basket does include the proportion of value-added products, including, by the way, automotives, which are very, very important as well. Spoke to the last one, the Honourable Martinez, about the auto sector. The auto sector has something like, yeah.
Well, I thought I would tolerate the minister. First and second time. I think now is to correct him. My surname is, I was printed out first and pronounced it. M-A-T-I-A-S-E.
Matthias.
And he spelled out M-A-T-I-A-S-E. It's pronounced Matthias.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Matthias. I didn't know your name before either. I was trying to pick it up from the apologies for that. I just wanted to say that there's on the question of the water sector. The water sector has reached to at least six other sectors in South Africa. The way the program works, we do have a tariff in place on finished automotives, quite a significant tariff. But companies that are part of the motor program are allowed to bring in some finished, completely built up units as part of the motor industry program. I think the motor industry program has generally made progress. As far as catalytic converters is concerned, I think that this is an industry that we need to be following through, as is the hydrogen fuel cells. We need to, particularly at a time when our customers for our products abroad are not buying as much at the same prices, we need to find different uses for the mineral wealth that we have, and in this case, platinum. We need to be working around ensuring that there is a price for platinum that supports the catalytic converting industry in this country, as well as the fuel cell industry. So we are doing that work, and it is my earnest hope that we will be able to address a number of these issues in the mining funding service result shortly.
Thank you very much, Mr. As I said to members, there is going to be a second round. This is the second round. So we've got your hand up already, Honourable McPherson, and we see by show of hands, Honourable Matthias, Honourable Albert, anyone else? Right, for the moment, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. I'm glad we're going to have some honesty hour. We'll get some honesty out of the responses. Minister, you want me to tell you what the contradictions between the NDP and IPAP is. NDP is market-driven, IPAP is state-driven. The state is God, the state is beyond sir, the state resolves all problems. But let's look at what the state has done in the last couple of years. And you say the reason why we're in the mess we are today, another excuse, is because of our mining economy. And you might have some point there. But why has it taken us so long to transform our economy to an entrepreneur-based, business-based, hard-employing economy? Because what we've done over the last 2 years, we've done everything possible to bash and beat and destroy and regulate and tell business what they can and can't do and how you should open a business, who you should employ, where you should employ. That's what we've done. So no wonder all we've got today is a mining economy. So we had the opportunity to move into that space of an entrepreneur-based economy. We didn't do it. We didn't give people the opportunity to do so. We didn't construct a platform for that to happen. So that's the honesty of why we are where we are today. Now, moving up the value chain, I agree with you about the value chain, but let's just look at sort of the metal side of the value chain. So we want something that you advocate very strongly for is that steel producers must give a discount. Must give a discount. That's being patriotic. Must give a discount. They can't even open their doors at the moment. How do you expect value additions to take place in the steel industry when the steel industry is collapsing before our very eyes? We don't even have the electricity to do so. I mean, thank goodness we haven't had blackouts for the last week. I mean, that's the only good news that this country has had in the last month. With regards to the rationalization of boards, that's the one good thing that you have done, and I want to praise you for that. I think that is the way to go, and I think that we can see more successes like that. No one wants to see these loads of boards on entities, because that's where the administration and corruption comes in. My question to you specifically with regards to that is, when will that process be completed for all boards? It was bizarre that you mentioned the arms deal. I just wanted to clarify whether you supported the arms deal and the massive corruption that went through with that. I was just a bit clear when you were singing and phrases, if you can just clarify for me on that. But I want to bring your attention to an example of how wrong the state can get it. And I don't know if you've read through the annual report, but there's something called the Enterprise Investment Program. That really should be sort of the investment into small businesses, into businesses off of the ground. And unfortunately, when you go through the values of investment, the targets that were supposed to be achieved, every single one, bar one, has been missed, including a number of new jobs underachieved by 3,000, number of incubators underachieved by 44, you were supposed to prove 50 and to pitch. Under the MCEP program, the number of jobs that were supposed to be retained from approved enterprises that were supposed to, the topic was still at 100,000, we only managed to do 37,000, we underachieved by 61,000 jobs, which means we still spent the same amount of money, but it cost two-thirds more than last year to retain or put up. Sorry, you're shaking your head, ma'am. I just want to know if you disagree with me on that.
Just a minute.
I thought you may have disagreed with me.
You're losing your time.
And I'm not saying that there's not a place for incentives. There are. But we need to take a real, honest look at where we are as a country, as an economy, as a department. And we can't be spending half of our budget on export promotion, on SAF, and then spending 1% of that, or the actual budget for export promotion, on actually promoting exports. We need to take a hard look at sectors that we're supporting. I agree, Chair, that we shouldn't be a mineral-only economy. We should be diverse. But if we're going to be diverse, we have to empower and assist those that can move this economy forward, the entrepreneurs in South Africa. Instead of trying to restrict them, we need to assist them. That's what we really need to do. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. Yes, Honourable Matthews.
Madam Chair. The Minister and the DG will recall the poem to J.R. Tolkien, when he says, all that he does is not good. But I also disagree with him when he says, not all those who wander are lost. I think your ministry is lost, if not your entire government is lost. Truth be told. And I agree partly with Honourable McPherson that in some of the, not entirely before what he says. And I'm making this point not as someone who's oblivious of the history of plunder and misrule and separate racist development in the country. Not because of that. Make no mistake of that. But I think 21 years is pretty enough for you to have used trial and error to see what works and what fails, what can work, what can take your country forward. Look, our country now, currently, taking all the platinum group metrics combined, and I'm advancing an argument here about our automobile industry, that the platinum group metals combined towards the expansion and the beneficiation of platinum metals towards the catalytic converters and related components. What we produce currently and what we supply for the entire world stands about 72%, of which we only share 8% of that. It's quite a mess, and you'd have to explain, not now, later in your life, after retirement. And you have to justify it to your grandchildren. Why was that the case? When we supply so much, and yet we own so little, and out of that, the country cannot benefit downstream, and that cannot contribute towards more job opportunities and all of that. So we can't be sitting here and give all excuses. When you should, of course, as government, be proactive and intervene decisive. So that's the first point. The second point is about the textile and clothing industries. I agree with you. But we cannot forever one in loss. South Africa is a country of offensive labor. People who are roaming around with not knowing what to do at the end of the day and all of that. Why don't you use that as the investment to take your country forward and invest just as you do in automobile and other industries, in textile and clothing industry. Get the people off the streets, get them into industries and work. But you cannot do that. You know what? If you lack political will, you wander endlessly and you really don't know what to do. Perhaps this is right, and that you admit that you don't really know what to do. And I'm raising this frankly with you. I'm not being arrogant, I'm merely ringing the bells of a ticking time bomb. That our people, especially the unemployed, cannot take it any further. You know that. And your government also know that. Because you know we do something about how we drive our economy, how we make it responsive to the needs of our people. That time is now, and we cannot wander in loss forever. Thanks, Manager.
Thank you, Honourable Matthias, Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Minister. I'm not quite sure if you did answer my first question partially, but I don't think I have a full answer, and that is the alternative forms of implementing a plan for our economy and allowing it to grow. I've taken note of your point that there are other countries that have also contracted, like Australia and so forth, and we are in a difficult international environment. But I think we need to pull a rabbit out of the hat in a very innovative way. As the Honourable Matthias had indicated, that this is true, that South Africa has a ticking time bomb in terms of our unemployment. And while there are successes within the IPAC program, I think we need to find, in addition to that, or supplanting that, some way of pulling our economy out of the doldrums. And one way to do it is to look at different plans comparatively, obviously, and to see which one will work for us, and to take a base from the world and building something that will be unique for South Africa. So take a base practice from the world. And I would like to know whether there is a process like that in the DTI from your economists and your knowledgeable people who are actually engaging in this type of thinking, so that we can say one day, but we did look at all the alternatives, and what we have here is a base we can offer for South Africa. Just a second question then. One of the industries that create jobs quite easily and allows for on-the-job training, you don't need necessarily any formal training, is the film industry. And I know the film industry is doing very well in South Africa, as you've indicated, and there are more applications, as I understand, there's money available. Would you be willing to look at putting more funding towards the film industry and expanding that industry, as it is one of the ones that really works well, and I think needs your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Albert. Are there any other questions, Honourable Kalaku? Do you wish? Yes. I just want to raise a couple of issues in this direction, and that is, I appreciated that the Minister could indicate to us when the right for South Africa to secure the geographical indicate status, the way our scheme was granted. Because, I mean, when we came into DTI, when I did in 2009, this was a huge issue that we spent a lot of money trying to secure in this direction. The other issue with respect to this are perhaps some of the things I'd like to highlight, and perhaps just to clarify with yourself. I know at one point you referred to using, or someone did, from the department, that they were in fact utilizing some of the experience from Vietnam with respect to footwear, and that they expected this to, you know, certainly show itself in the near future. And it would appear as if this is really doing well in the footwear industry itself. But would also like, and I was just trying to quickly get to see if you indicate what is the scale of jobs that have been created there as well. The other thing is, with respect to the different pieces of legislation and so on, now I know there has been a reference by one of the members to possibly, I'm just going to call it red tape, perhaps too much red tape for business or whatever. But essentially, in some of my experience, one has tried to persuade the private sector to come on board with perhaps BBBE, the improvement thereof, even doing designations to encourage focus, if you like, in the local manufacturing. And that hasn't always been taken up with the same enthusiasm one has hoped for in this regard. The other issue that one would like to refer to, and I was just trying to get it, was the Saldanha Bay issue. We did go there in January, I think it was, the committee, And certainly we were impressed by future plans thereof. It's certainly rewarding to hear that there has been from the SEZ side, the Special Economic Zone side, some investment has come through. But perhaps what is more important, and that is to try to look at industrial policy action plan, which we're doing, and to drill down and ask ourselves just how much more can we do in terms of the localization program itself with respect to the public sector, which we know has earmarked, if I'm not mistaken, about 70-odd%. I could be wrong, but procurement. And to try and persuade the private sector, and I think this is the point I like to make, one does start off by persuasion, and one certainly hopes that, you know, a sector, either the public or private sector, would heed that. And then when it isn't heeded 20 years later, you find yourself having to look at other measures. And my appeal to the private sector is, look, we're all in this country together. We can make progress together. We can create jobs. But we have got to consider opening the door to localized products in the private sector and not just utilize the public sector always to rely on procurement. But Mr. Njiti, there have been some serious points made here, and one would like to get you to respond to them as best you can. Thank you. What you feel you'd like to come back to in writing or at another time, we would also welcome. But looking at the clock there, it looks like about half an hour or so left. Thank you.
I'm not surprised that the opposition parties have got differences with us over conceptual issues, but I'm a little bit surprised that is how close the EMF and the DA appear to be on this matter. So let me start off by saying that I don't accept the characterization that the Honourable Magnificent made. I don't believe that the NDP is about markets any more than I believe that IPAC is about state-driven. I don't believe either of them are like that. I think both of them are a combination of markets and state in them. So I don't accept the characterization to start with. What I do think, though, is that in the IMAP, what is necessary is for states to do a number of things to support the manufacturing sector, which, by the way, is overwhelmingly private. So there's hardly any, as I can't remember, any part of manufacturing that is actually state-owned. And we have sought to expand state ownership in manufacturing. What we have sought to do is to work with the manufacturing sector and develop programs of consultation with the manufacturing sector, but where the state can come in and create a supportive environment as well as work with manufacturers around the resolution of common problems. And I think that actually our record does show that we've got some successes now. And what I would want to say is that we can have a debate about the direction of whether we should have an industrial policy or not. I think that the case for an industrial policy is manifestly proven, not just by what we have achieved in South Africa with our industrial policies and the ICAP was unfolded as an action plan, but also with the experience of many other emerging and developing economies. In fact, the whole world that is industrialized has had an active industrial policy. It may be that we're in a different philosophical and ideological space on this matter. I think that may well be right. And I do think that your approach is a different one. I know your, I don't remember his name, but the fellow who is your spokesperson on small business wrote a piece once and he said that it's in his view the NDP is Thatcherism. I think that I wouldn't agree with that characterization of the NDP either. But I do believe that the way that the state is to play an active role is supporting the engendering an industrialization process is growing across the board. Does that mean that everything we do, every implementation has been perfect? Very far from it. And I think that I'm prepared to adopt an approach where we have it goes back to discussions I've had all throughout my professional life, critical support. If we support the idea of industrialization, we support the idea of an industrial program, what we need to do is we really carefully and critically
at areas where we can improve. And I think that is part of the approach that we need adopting. Where we look through and we see that something hasn't been working, we must be willing to make changes and make improvements. And I think the philosophy that we've been following since I've been in charge of this ministry has been one of continuous improvement. What I don't think is that we sit around and we face a set of challenges, serious challenges, and we suddenly say, oh my goodness, we don't know what we're doing. We're lost. Let's throw it all out and let's call everybody in and have another seminar and discuss it and we'll design something completely different, because I don't think the evidence justifies that. The film industry is a sector that has shown promise, but we put money into the film industry. But can we say, well, let's give up the auto industry, let's give up the games in money, the clothing textile industry, and let's all throw all the money to the film industry? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't think the Honourable Albers is saying it, so I'm making a ridiculous example. There's no magic bullet, is the point I really want to make. There's no magic bullet in any one particular sector. For what it's worth, we have decided that we need to take some of the areas where we have been doing some work, and we need to turn them into much more solid sectoral programs. One of those is metals fabrication capital equipment, that sector, where we think that it's very, very important that we gain much more of the manufacturing input into the infrastructure program. We have some very good examples. We make railway locomotives for shunting in ports and so on. RRL Grindrod is the company. They make these others, and they are the most effective locomotives of their kind that are found on the African continent. We do have capacities in areas where we can build. On the question of the iron and steel issue, you know, ironically, because of the state of the iron and steel industry now, we are in a much better space in terms of discussion about the pricing policy than we've been for a long time. That's irony. That is the irony. I don't know if you follow the conditions that we put on the tariff adjustment. We said we were prepared to put on a 10% increase in the tariff in certain steel lines where the application went through ITAC, and ITAC is going to make its recommendations. But we engaged very actively with the steel makers to determine the set of conditions that would apply. And the one obvious condition is that they are not going to be allowed to simply add 10% to the domestic price of steel. Rather, what they should do is they should see the tariff as going some little way, only a little way, towards leveling the playing field in the competition with imported steel products, which will attract a duty of 10%. That's just one of the measures that are underway. But we are engaged with a discussion about the future pricing policy of steel and the relationship between that and supply of iron ore. And because we are making sure that when we defend, and I think this is the approach, when we defend the upstream steel manufacturing, which we need to do because I said earlier on, there's a glut of steel, there's a huge competitive struggle, there's probably a need on the world scale to close down several steel plants, which is going to be ours, somebody else's, we need to make sure it's not ours. We don't lose upstream steel manufacturing in this country. So that's one of the measures that we've introduced. But we've done it in such a way and with in interaction with the industry where we are not going to see the price simply raised, and where we, I think, are probably in a much better position to actually address the question of the challenge we've had around steel prices. The electricity issue is, of course, a critical challenge. I have not denied that, but I'm just saying that I think that we've made some progress in the electricity issue. We're not out of the woods yet, but I think we have made some progress. Let me say on the arms deal, there is a commission of inquiry. It's an intermission of inquiry, it's looking at all the matters. What I simply wanted to say is that people around who would say, like I would say, the Solidity Commission will discover and will report on whether there was corruption, and if there was, that will have to be dealt with. But the other people around who who want to argue and go further, we should never have done the arms deal, and so on and so forth. I'm simply saying, well, maybe the country needs it. Well, that view, then maybe you're not so pleased about the K-Nub film studio, because it was partly funded by an offset from the arms deal. By the way, we won't allow those kind of things any longer under the review that we've done of the National Industrial Participation Program, because we're actually saying that offsets will from now on have to be the industry where the where procurement was located in the third place, but it was just by the line. So I want to say that I do think that we do need honest review and conversation about what works, what doesn't work itself. But I would want to suggest, as a hypothesis, that we are the track that we've identified of moving up the value chain, of industrializing the continent, of moving out of the place of the world in the global division of labor, that is the right journey that we're on. And we can be extremely critical about whether this, that, or the other measure that we've adopted is getting us there. But I would want to suggest that in each some of the cases, like the bitter industry program, the program on the clothing and textiles, but also a large number of other sectors and of processing, parts of the steel and capital goods sector, chemicals, and others, we have seen that I think that there's progress that comes when we have an industrial policy, which, by the way, is not reducible either only to the quotas and incentives, although the incentives are an important point. I think the question of the incentives is that there's a quid pro quo to be getting return to that, and that's something that we need to strengthen as well. Then, I don't know. I really think I really covered what I think I want to say about the Honourable Matias. He says that we lost, and he reasons that first, and I thought that was certainly partially. That's really quite interesting. Doesn't believe that we should be we've been having too much state intervention. I know that part of it he agrees with. In any case, I think that we of course know that we have a very serious challenge of unemployment, and particularly of youth unemployment, and that all the programs that we're doing are trying to create a new growth path to move on. I wish that we had started this ICAP when the good times are with us.
Yeah.
In 2002, something like that, when Brazil started their program. I wish we'd done that. We didn't have that luxury, so we'd be trying to do this against some very, very heavy hindrance. That's the reality. And I think that we have shown that we are better off for having done it than for not. And I would want to just contend that if we hadn't done what we were going to do, we would not have had a clothing textile industry in this country by now. We would probably have a very pale shadow of what we've got to survive at all. We'd probably have an auto sector which was performing at a much lower level than it is now, if at all. I think we would have seen a serious deindustrialization which has stared us in the face. Let's not forget that in 2009, when the global economic crisis struck us, we lost 1 million jobs. 20% of those, 200,000 were in manufacturing, which was not 20% of the GDP. We faced a serious threat of deindustrialization. We haven't had that. We've managed to hold the line, evidently and obviously there's more that needs to be done. And what I've been saying is that the view I'm holding is not that we don't know what we're doing. We know what we're doing. We've got a challenge now. We've got to raise the scale of impact of our program. It's not going to be easy to bring about. It's going to be very, very difficult. Let me just say in relation to the question that the chair asked, the recognition of geographic indication for Roybos, Honeybush, and Karoo Lamb will come in when the Economic Partnership Agreement of the European Union comes in force. We recognize a number of the AGIs, and we've got recognition for some of ours, including those, but also some of the wine names. So the price we have to pay for some improvement, limited improvements in agricultural market access. Where is that at? The legal scrubbing process is now not including any issues of ours. The issues are things like, just to report to you, the European Union under Chapter 98 wants to say that it doesn't affect us, but that no developing country can be provided with duty-free access to the production of any arms or components that are going into them. That's a change in their policy in the view of the Shadow Eva Group, because it was previously East Development countries, and there are a couple of our neighbours that have been producing components and so on. That issue is still in the legal study, and it's quite out of the issue, I don't recall it right now, but that should happen fairly soon. And then on Saldana, we have a significant number of investors that are interested in Saldana. One of the outcomes of Operation Matisa was a commitment to build 9 billion rand dedicated a facility for oil and gas servicing. When we went there, this is what we found, is that once you walk onto an oil rig, you actually have to meet certain safety qualifications, even if you're painting or something like that. And the real issue is going to be how do we make the space for local companies employing local people to be able to do work on those oil rigs. It's one of the issues, and we have brought our team around. I'm glad that the reforms that we've been bringing about in terms of different agencies have met the approval of the Honourable MacPherson. But let me just say to you that we're not saying that every entity will not have a board any longer. There is a case of having a board, I think, when we're talking about distributing and financial resources, things like that. But where we're talking about entities that conduct a regulatory role, we decided that we're bringing it into the department. That's what we do. That's what the NRCS is now. The NRCS is there with the board. And I think it's better for it. Thanks.
Very quickly on some of the questions, an honourable point was asked about the employment in the film sector. Here the number is 61,611, but again as mentioned that our film incentive is more than 10 years old, but also we constantly adapted it to make it, to make it more attractive over time. Mr. asked the question about the rooibos, but we initialed that agreement in July last year, where, as I said, we've now got the agreement. Implementation, as Minister said, now depends just on the European Union's internal process. I think on the question of the EIP scheme and us not meeting our targets, I think that's correct. We, as I said, as a department, we set very hard targets. So we set very hard employment targets for that scheme. But as we said, because this is a private sector driven process, the applications we received, their capital labor ratios were not as labor intensive as we wanted it to be. So that is the reality that the applications we had was for more capital intensive projects, but more value added projects. So you'll face this problem of higher value add, but lower employment intensity in that sector. But as we deal with the business processing, we are learning from these things. We are now adapting our incentives so that we give a bias towards more labor intensive activities, or we give extra incentive. What we're also doing, we also discontinued the EIP program. That is the reality. And we've now submerged them because they were covering similar matters as in the NSEC program. But now that we have more applications than we have resources, we obviously now have to be more selective. Now, before we approved every applicant we received, so whether you were capital intensive or more, we approved you. Now, as I said, the NSEP is working for the new round. We're looking at saying that there are projects which have a higher impact. We will approve those ones. So that is where we strengthen the conditionality, and then definitely labor intensity will be one of the ones which we will definitely put high up the hierarchy for incentives. But I thought it's important just to clarify the EIP program. The question was answered, but I wanted hanging is the Honorable Hugh Lewis asked about the perceptions index and us dropping out of the Ernst & Young index. I think, as I said, the answer to that is that that is a perceptions-based index. That is, it does a survey and it asks people, what do you think about the investment climate in South Africa? The others, what we are basing our figures on is the official United Nations figures in actual investment we are achieving. So that accounts for the disjuncture. But Ernst & Young at the World Economic Forum earlier this year, they released the same company as Ernst & Young, but they released the African investment report. And what they, the
what they then said is, there is such a thing, they did two perception surveys. They made a perception survey for people who are already invested in South Africa and on the continent. And they did, some of them were not invested. And they identified a gap. Those who are already have companies in Africa or in South Africa are very confident about South Africa. I think it's 60 or 71% confidence. Whereas those who are not on the view, it's about 30%. So that's why they said there's this perception gap between people. So I think that explains the situation, that, and that explains what Minister says about Unilever. Those who are already on the continent are very confident about the African story. Those are outside, and I think that's the challenge. But I think it's very important to say that it's a perceptions index, and it's not the actual figures that we base our on. I just wanted to clarify those ones.
Because we are running a little out of time at this point, what I really appreciate from the department, you've got a lot under the, you know, the work reference to it, and very well laid out and found easy accessible. But what would be helpful, as we said this last year, was the when we have these investments, manufacturing, etc., creation of jobs, how many of these companies are actually establishing plants in the country? You know, to me, that is where we need to be. How many are establishing them right here? The second thing with respect to steel, what I'm concerned about is 3 years ago when this came up on the steel, and as a little here and making several presentations over a period of about a year or so, if not longer, the request and it eventually, you know, developed into an insistence on the majority of the members was, why can't you give us a developmental price? Now that was in Ansela Middle. Were earning a lot of money, not when they were, as they put it now, they really, it's not viable to continue under the present situation. So it seems, you know, when they are very viable, when they are making profits, they won't do it. When they are making, when they're not making all the profits they have projected, it's still not, you know, going to happen. So I do have a, you know, any concern that in the private sector, we never seem to get what could be recalled a reliable response in this direction, a response that holds a little bit more water and doesn't shift all along the line. Because we said to them, the majority, you know, manufacturing depends on steel. And we heard that indeed the DPI were trying to work with Kumba and the issues around there. That just comes to pass. So it would be helpful if, again, the DG, the department, could give us just in a page or so a breakdown. What happened? They couldn't do it then. They can't do it now. What is the problem then? What exactly is the problem? Because we are using a lot of steel. Notwithstanding that I think the committee appreciates the tariff that you had to put in, because what is happening was an element, something very close to getting steel dumped in South Africa. It was a very fine line there. So we do appreciate the department's prompt action in this regard, also one of its agencies. I check. Am I correct? You correct me?
No, yes, sir. Let me just say one thing that I was saying, and I think you haven't heard me correctly. The conversation about the pricing policy is a lot more positive now than it was then. That's what I'm saying. It's not that they couldn't do it then, they can't do it now. I think the conversation is a lot more positive. I haven't got any details yet, but I'm just saying that to you. And that there is an indication that there will be further tariff applications, including applications that will be for anti-dumping duties. The maximum bound rate for steel is 10%. That's what they got on certain lines. There's another application on other lines that is still forthcoming. ITAC will have to follow its due process, apply its mind, and make recommendations and respond to that.
Thank you very much, and it's good that you brought the
a fairly large team along with you. Members will then have that engagement with DCI, the annual reports and so on, and we certainly try to give it a fair amount of time for members to engage. But if any member here feels that there is a burning question that they would like to see responded to, please put it to myself and Mr. Medina, and we will forward it to the DCI for a written response before we conclude our report in this area. On the 9th of September, Wednesday, we are meeting a lot earlier because we are going to begin with the bill, the public hearings on the promotion and protection of investment bill. At the same time, we are required to push through the, and here, the briefing and consideration of the additional protocol to the Trade Development and Cooperation Agreement, TDCA, between the European Community and its member states on the one part, and the Republic of South Africa on the other side, to take account of the accession of the Republic of Croatia to the European Union. We are obliged to process this. It's not a choice. We must do it, and I think we all say that we would allocate this. It probably won't take an hour, but we're not sure. It takes something across up. The sooner we can get into the bill, the better it will be for us. Am I correct on that front? Then the public hearings. And on those public hearings, the people who will be here in that, on the first day will be the Centre for Constitutional Rights, the Centre for Applied Legal Studies, the South African Human Rights Commission, the European Union, the Mandela Institute, NUMSA. That is what we have so far. As I have said to members all along the line, you are welcome to have put forward any stakeholder that you thought may have been able to contribute and add to our understanding and to the debate. But we are getting a very tight program. This bill has been backwards and forward. How long has this bill been in the public spotlight, Minister?
Well, it's only been in the public spotlight when we tabled it in Parliament, it's the cabinet, the bill is just, but the idea of the bill has been around 2 years.
It has been around nearly 3 years, so the bill is here, and we must actually begin to process it. Thank you very much, Mr. DG, and do go around and have a look at the stalls. Thank you. Meeting adjourned until tomorrow morning.